Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Bite Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And just like that, we're back with Fight Night Picks, getting set for UFC Fight Night. Cater versus our namesake. It's Arnold Allen getting an opportunity, his first main event in the UFC. Thank you
well
so
deserved.
Much for joining us, as always, with Fight Night Picks, one half of your duo. It's Craig Allen, Craig Allen FNP. That's where you can find me. And many of you have, because with the recent string of success, Matt, where can they find you on the socials?
At Matt Allen FNP. And yeah, not to toot our horns or anything, because here's the thing. We're going to go on some bad streaks. We're going to go on some good streaks. We'll acknowledge when we go on those losing streaks. But boy, it feels good to be on top right now, doesn't it? I know you've been your own worst enemy the past 2 weeks. If we could be completely transparent, that's the thing. We do question mark kicks 2 hours before the fights start. If you've never checked it out, make sure that you do. But it does give us a final chance to go back and change any picks that we might have originally made. In the last 2 weeks, Craig would have beat me by one pick.
In each
of them, exactly. So it would have been up 2 picks on the year. And I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to the leaderboards, but Craig could have used those 2 picks. But you changed your mind on the last day, so hopefully we can buck that trend. Hopefully it's nothing but success for both of us here on out.
We're going to stick with it, and again, we're looking forward to a big-time, small-time card. And originally, we had a number of fights on this card. It was looking like Mark Madsen was going to be booked in a couple of big-time pairings. They fell out. Cody Durden, Clayton Rodriguez, that fell out. You also had today, on Sunday, as we tape these, Garrett Armfield taking on Christian Rodriguez. I was really looking forward to that fight, and all of a sudden, that one's off the card. So as it stands, there's only 9 fights when we're breaking this down. But I'll tell you what, Fight Night Picks fans, what we'll do, we'll throw out this full card video. Make sure you tune in. We're going to have a lot of fun with these
exactly.
ones. And then throughout the week, if there's some additions, which typically there are, we'll be as quick as humanly possible to get those out for you. So you'll more than likely see the individual videos a little bit earlier than you normally do. But when we lock in and we get set for this card, last weekend, a 4 out of 5 star card on Fight Matrix, UFC 280. It was a really good card on paper. It was a pretty decent card as it played out. This card coming up this weekend, they have it tentatively listed as 2.5 stars. If you look, Bellator also has a card this week. You have the return of Mansoor Barnawi. I mean, man, he is going to be rock'em sock'em over with Bellator. Take on Adam Piccolotti, and for those folks, 1.5 stars. So you have a Bellator card earlier on Saturday, UFC also on Saturday, and Matt already mentioned question mark kicks, but we have a big time card. I mean, you look at it, Calvin Kattar's ranked 5th, Arnold Allen's ranked 6th, and in a light heavyweight contest, the only other ranked fighter on the card, number 13 at light heavyweight, Dustin Jacoby taking on Khalil Roundtree. But Matt, for Fight Night Picks fans and for hardcore MMA fans, there's some really good matchups just in these 9 fights.
And that's what I wanted to talk about. This fight, this whole card, it's kind of like fast food, but it's not McDonald's. It's not Wendy's. It's like that good fast food.
Chipotle.
Exactly. It's Chipotle. We have a place in town called Taco Boys that I like. It's kind of fast food. It doesn't take that long. It's just things like that. This isn't, wow, way to... Don't talk negative about a small business. Wait, just things like that. Look after yourself. It's like St. Hubert. There you go. You can either get the Burger King, which is fast. You're probably not going to feel good the next day. Or you can get the nice piece of chicken that you're not going to regret. I think it is a fun card, though. Like you said, we've only got 9 fights to talk about. But they're 9 pretty fun fights.
Matt, you can go to St. Hubert, the real one, or St. Hubert Express. And you're talking Express. We're talking quick chicken.
But
when you have a look at the overall card, it is a pretty decent one. And we're going to throw it on over to that fight of the night screen. Listen, 9 fights to choose from. Pretty hard to get this one wrong at the start of the week. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in the fight of the night screen.
Let us know down below in the comments section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
Listen, we like to be hipsters here with Fight Night Picks. Yeah. Not going to happen this week. We're going to cherry pick Tim Means, the Dirty Birds, taking on Max Payne Griffin. And for both these guys, in terms of their fight of the night likeliness, they're not necessarily known for their bonus structure in that juncture, but when you do look at both of these guys, they do like to throw down. They have very intense styles, and I think this is going to play out as one of those co-main events that you can't miss and you gotta tell your friends about.
100%. This fight to me is kind of like one of those players on a favorite team that you like. It's like Norman Powell. That's what this fight reminds me of. Not gonna make an all-star game, not gonna make an all-NBA. When it's all said and done, probably not gonna be remembered as one of the greats. But champion, if you were a fan of that team, if you were around for the time period in which he played for the team that you liked, then you're gonna remember him very fondly. That's what I think about this fight. I think Max Griffin and Tim Means is gonna be a fight that's going to be pretty high level. They're both good technicians. They both do everything quite well, but it's going to be a fun barn burner at the end of the day.
And I mean, it's hard to deny that. We talk about not wanting to try and cherry pick off the top, but when you look at the top of this card, Cater versus Allen, two top ranked featherweights in this division that's absolutely loaded with talent. However, now all of a sudden it's logjammed. It seems like your champion wants to move up to 155 pounds. Volkanovski wants to fight with Makhachev. Seems like it's Perth, maybe in Australia. They've got a big card coming up. So when you do figure this fight could be for a title contender, maybe the winner gets an interim championship opportunity. You look at Arnold Allen, first main event. You look at Calvin Kattar. This is fifth main event in a row. You look at the graphic on the screen. And if you're listening to the podcast, I apologize to you, but I'll walk it back. We threw it out there to you in the community tab. We wanted your votes for our poster for the week for that thumbnail. Listen, I did a little bit of Google Trends. I was a little bit selective, and I thought, hey, the fans like that fight against Chikadze. They like that knockout against Dan Hooker. I'll throw that out there. You guys didn't vote for this one necessarily. We threw it to just that simplified version, but both of those guys in those performances looked amazing. And for Kattar's last time out, had a good say in getting the win 3-2 over Josh Emmett. Lose the split decision there, but overall, this is a very, very high-level fight.
Exactly. How could you not pick the top fight? Like, this main event between Arnold Allen and Calvin Kattar feels like a long time coming. They've both been on similar trajectories, if we're being honest. Just Calvin Kattar's been able to fight guys at the top of the division for a little bit longer throughout his career up until this point. But Calvin Kattar has proved that if he is in a fight against another marquee name, it's going to be an absolute barn burner. He's fought guys like Jeremy Stephens, Dan Ige. That fight was a really complete performance by him. We're all going to remember the crazy Max Holloway fight that he had. He may not have been on the winning side of that, but still, Calvin Kattar made a very good account of himself. And I think against Arnold Allen, their styles against each other are going to make for a phenomenal fight.
Should be a great one. Again, you have seven other fights to choose from. There are some good ones down below. Make sure you comment with your pick for Fight of the Night. So keep it in mind again, the fact that we could end up adding some fights to this card, not by our choosing, but by the UFC's. And as it stands, we've had fights like Armfield Rodriguez drop off very, very shortly. We also had Clayton Rodriguez, who's supposed to take on Cody Durden. That was already a short notice fight. Vinicius Salvador, the one that was originally out against Durden, fall off the card. So as it stands, only 9 on this one. We're gonna rock, we're gonna roll, we're gonna have a lot of fun on this one. We also have the UFC debut of the DRs, Waldo Cortez Acosta, a big time heavyweight striker, taking on Jared Vandera, the Mountain, as he was formerly known. He's been more like a small hill. And if we have a look, we also have the second time out for Josh Fremd on this card, taking on Trayshawn Gore. Thoughts were high on Gore coming into the UFC, and boy, he's fallen on hard times. So, it's a Fight Night Pick special, Matt, and I'm really eager to break down these fights.
So am I. I think there's a lot of fights that people can get excited for, and really, that's all we care about at the end of the day.
Matt, it should be an amazing one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, we have a couple of massive featherweights going at it. It's the boy wonder, Chase Hooper. I mean, listen, I've been trying to pop. Now I'm on like Shumpert. And Matt, can you believe it? Like, I did a deep dive today on Amon Shumpert. Not just Jack Harlow lyrics, but on Amon Shumpert.
He won Dances with the Stars.
Dancing with the Stars. He had his own reality show. He
Pretty
was
cool
also
dude.
A 2016 NBA champion. And for Amon Shumpert, I remember him as the guy from the Knicks that tried to shave the Adidas logo into his hair, and then the NBA made him shave it out.
That's
but
good.
Couldn't believe it. He made $48 million in career earnings.
That's why I say, if you're good at sports, like all of them, pick basketball to go professional in.
He was also and is still married to Tiana Taylor, and boys, he's just a winner in life.
Wow.
So when you do focus on it for the boy wonder, Chase Hooper, second camp out of Upstate Karate in Simpsonville, South Carolina, looking to capitalize on the fact that he just won his first UFC performance bonus in a finish win over Felipe Klarich. He looked very, very good in that fight. And even if you consider it for Chase Hooper, a guy who's primarily known for that jiu-jitsu pedigree, pedigree. He's been a black belt for some time. Still very young, just over 23 years old, coming into this matchup against the mean machine, Steve Garcia. For Hooper, not the best with his offensive takedowns, not the best with his defensive wrestling, not the best with his striking defense, getting better with his striking offense. But the best part about Chase Hooper, and it showed out in his fight against Felipe Klarich's last time, the fact that he is so slippery on the ground, so physically strong to get exactly from a bottom position back up to the top. And we've seen him struggle in fights like he did against Alex Caceres, where he tried to pull guard, like he did against Daniel Peterson. No. When he was just held down for minutes on end. He didn't look very good in that fight. For Hooper, that Klarich fight really did kind of, it was a palate cleanser for me in the mind watching that one. And for Hooper in the UFC, I've had a really rough time trying to cap some of his fights. I went back just to see who I had picked in his fights in the UFC. So let me indulge you, Fight Night Picks fans. We both had Hooper to beat Daniel Taymor. Watch out for your underwears. We had Hooper to beat
his brother.
We had Hooper to beat Caceres. We got that one wrong. We had Hooper to beat Barrett. He beat Barrett quite easily. I had Peterson to beat Hooper, and so did you. And then in the fight against Klarich, we both had Klarich at the start of the week, and I believe you switched to Hooper on question mark
kicks.
So I've
done all right picking Chase Hooper fights.
You've done all right, but and I've done all right too. I have a really hard time trying to gauge Chase Hooper, because in a matchup like this against Steve Garcia, it might actually swing Garcia's way in terms of that striking and the striking defense we've seen out of Chase Hooper.
I didn't know what rap reference you were going to make at the start, but I can continue with it. For Chase Hooper, he must feel like the ones who hate him the most look just like him, because I don't think Chase Hooper was met with the warm welcome that a lot of these top tier younger prospects have felt when they initially came to the UFC. Think back to fighters like Sage Northcutt, fighters like Mickey Gall. I understand they never had the long term success that you would really like to see out of people who their UFC really invested in. You can mention a name like Paige VanZant as well. Remember how young she was when she initially got her first main event? She fought Rose Namajunas for a main event, never really proved anything after that, and then fought Michelle Waterson on Big Fox.
And I mean, the craziest part about that too, you're talking about Rose Namajunas, big documentary coming out, and for Paige VanZant, her videos are different on the internet.
They certainly are. I think they're behind a paywall, but I don't know for a fact. What I do know about Chase Hooper though is, it does feel like the average MMA fan is still left wanting a little bit more out of Hooper. And that's the weird thing about MMA, and the UFC in particular, signing these very young prospects. The good thing about being a Bellator, a KSW, an LFA if you will, and I know an LFA is lesser than those two previous organizations, but hear me out. Organizations like those can sign fighters who are 0-1, 1-1, 2-1, guys who might not have the sexiest of records or resumes, but show insane promise, because the thing is, they can develop them a lot more. They don't have as many mainstream eyes on them, so they can let these fighters really marinate, try to develop over time, and then once they get to the top of the card, that's when they can promote them. And in the UFC, you have to remember, for every Chase Hooper, for every, I guess Sage Northcutt's a better example, for every Sage Northcutt, there's a Sonya Dong. So maybe Chase Hooper is able to go on that really long win streak and finally flesh out some of the other skills that he has shown potential in. But so far, I gotta be honest, I really have expected a little bit more out of Hooper. Now, you bring up the improvements in his striking, in some of his striking defense, and I do agree, he has gotten better over time. But when you're that young and the UFC really does invest in you, I do expect you to be a little bit kind of that next level star. And maybe that's me expecting too much out of him. I can openly admit that. But in this fight against Steve Garcia, I think this is kind of his last chance to really prove it. We know what he does better than Steve Garcia. That's 100% the grappling. We know what Steve Garcia does better than Chase Hooper. On the feet, I don't even know if it's close, to be completely honest and transparent with you.
And I think that Chase Hooper showed in his last fight against Klarich that he is developing that offense of striking skill set.
Right.
He was marching him down. He was throwing in combination. His strikes really did look good. The only problem with Hooper, and we saw that even in his fight on Dana White's Contender Series, he can get backed up, drop his hands, and then just kind of freeze up, and that's when fighters can unload. He got dropped in early on in his fight on Contender Series. Alex Caceres dropped him.
Daniel Taymor had him in a lot of trouble too at the start of their fight. Now, I know he got the win, but still, the win kind of erases all the negatives.
And in the Caceres fight, I mean, 3x30-27 was what the judges had it in the fight against Peterson. Two had it 30-27, one had it 29-28, but it all boils down to the fact that Hooper's finally just been fixed, not just in Washington or Vegas or wherever, but in South Carolina, getting ready with Ray and the boys, Steven as well. We're talking about those crazy, crazy karate fellas, the Thompsons, getting ready at Upstate Karate, working that game plan. And for Steve Garcia, I mean, he grew up at Jackson Wink. He grew up in the gyms around the New Mexico area. He had a little bit of wrestling in his back pocket. And from what we've seen in the UFC, it's been a decent level of competition. He came in on really short notice, took on a guy in Luis Pena on 5 days' notice, and he didn't look very good. I mean, it really fought to the skill set of Pena in that one. But if you consider it, I mean, he took on Ontiveros. He could drop twice early. He rallies in that one, wrestles him down, finishes him by ground and pound. And if you do consider it in the losses, I mean, Pena, it was quite a while ago, almost 3 years ago, beat Charlie Ontiveros a year ago. And then his last time out against Mahashata, neither one of us picked Mahashata to win. Mahashata was a big underdog. Garcia was a minus 200 favorite. And in that one, Garcia was having a little bit of success at the start. He did look good. He gets dropped by a right cross, gets back up, and then he gets hit by that exact same right cross and face plants, and he's out at UFC 275, to the fact where he got performance of the nighted, as they say. They just put those swords over him, and that was it for Steve. KO.
And that's why I favor Chase Hooper in this matchup. The thing about Steve Garcia and his style, or at least what we know about it up until this point, is yes, he can wrestle offensively. You probably don't want to do that against Chase Hooper. I think we can all agree to that. He can strike, but he does get into a lot of those car crash type exchanges, and that's going to leave the door open for Chase Hooper to land a knee up the middle, an elbow on the inside. It might help accentuate some of Chase Hooper's power. Now, I understand getting into those exchanges are also going to really rough Chase Hooper up. Steve Garcia, like I said before, is a much better striker on the outside, I would say, but also on the inside. I just think the way he strikes is going to open the door for Chase Hooper to take advantage of some of those openings, be it with either the striking defense or with the takedown defense, while Steve Garcia is really trying to be offensive with his own strike.
And if you do consider it for Steve Garcia, this is first fight at featherweight since 2020. Missed weight in a fight against Jose Mariscal, weighed in at 147.4. The main event of LFA 40. He has experience at bantamweight, featherweight, and lightweight. All of them at lightweight in the UFC. We have a look at the odds in this matchup. Hooper open to minus 185, minus 230 right now. For Garcia, open at a plus 165 or thereabouts. Plus 190 right now. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 77.5% for the Dream, Chase Hooper.
I think they'll be over.
They are over by a lot. 652 total votes. 91% Hooper. I was way off. 71% by submission. For the 9% that have Garcia, 51% by decision, 35% by knockout. Matt, do you think Chase Hooper's pretty without any makeup on? Do you think he likes that song? Because that used to be his nickname. It was the Teenage Dream. Now he's a man. It's the Dream.
Do you think he's funny when he tells the punchline wrong? And in every February, he'll be your Valentine.
Well, he was the UFC Journalist of the Year, like, last year. And he likes to do that stuff on the Twitter. What's the pick?
Fuck it. I'm going to say, let's go all the way tonight. No regrets. I'm picking Chase Hooper. Again, like I said, I do like Chase Hooper in some of the striking exchanges. I don't love him as a striker on the outside, like I had mentioned, but I think the threat of his grappling is going to help him on the feet a little bit in this matchup. And again, if the fight does end up hitting the mat, I like his submission ability. And the thing is, if Steve Garcia gets on top of Chase Hooper, yes, Garcia can get good work done, but I think Hooper can get a sweep. I think he can turn a bad situation into a good situation. And on the flip side, if Hooper gets on top of Steve Garcia, I think things are going to go south very fast for Garcia, and that's why I do favor Hooper in this matchup.
I feel like there's not a lot of underdog spots on this card. If I'm being completely honest, I can pick out a couple, and you'll see them on this entire main card or full card look. But when you consider Steve Garcia, punching power, continues to move forward, gets in the pocket, has good dirty boxing, all things that Chase Hooper has historically struggled with, regardless of the Upstate Karate pairing that he has at this point. I still like Chase Hooper in the matchup. I do like the fact that he can turn those bad positions into good positions on the ground, and I like the way that he flows with his grappling. His last time out, he beat the former Jungle Fights champ in Kolarish, who was moving back up to 145 pounds. He had been at 135 for a long time, but I will ever so slightly go with Chase Hooper here. Don't love the odds where they're at, and if you like Steve Garcia or Chase Hooper, you let us know down below in the comments section. Some big fights on this card. The Dirty Bird in the co-main event taking on Max Griffin. In the main event, Calvin Kattar, oh boy, against almighty Arnold Allen. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
With 16 finish wins between them. A couple of middleweight movers and shakers looking to get things done this weekend. We have a couple of oddball nicknames. It's the ugly man, Joseph Holmes, taking on the Iron Turtle, Junyoung Park. And it seems like a bit of a weird matchup, if we're all being completely honest, because for Park, he's kind of a finished product. And for Holmes, not that he's an unproven commodity, not that he's still a prospect, even though he's just at 8-2 in his overall career, but for Holmes, this is just his third fight in the UFC, and he's been fighting at a pretty quick pace to kick off his UFC tenure. I mean, he was featured on Dana White's Contender Series. Didn't really want him. Said, hey, he's accepted a fight on Looking for a Fight, so I guess we'll see what happens there. And then when he does go out on Dana White's Looking for a Fight, the Fury FC card, he knocks out poor old Jonathan Pati. Just a rolling punchline for UFC middleweights to be. Is Pati, that's the rhyme, and I'm going to stick with it. But for Holmes, he makes that UFC debut against Jamie Pickett. He comes in as a little bit of a favorite. And in that fight, he looked really good in the first round. It was a fight on somewhat of short notice, but round two, round three, started to run out of steam. The low volume really started to catch him, and Pickett was able to start to roll as that one went on. So for Holmes, we were left kind of scratching our heads until a bout sheet got signed and he got to fight Alan Amadovsky. And that kind of erased a lot of questions, but did it really? Because for Alan Amadovsky, you talk about punching bags, that poor, poor man just did not have a good run in the UFC. And for Holmes, he looked really good. He withstood a power puncher who tried to blitz him. He threw a couple of really good shots on one of those blitzes, landed a knee, drops him, and then as Amadovsky gets back up, Holmes presses him up against the cage, gets him down. No hooks on that rear naked choke. He gets it off to the side with his back to the cage. A great first round finish win for Joseph Holmes his last time out. And there's a lot of things that you can like and a couple of similarities that you can try and draw out of that. I mean, Alan Amadovsky, not the biggest, tallest middleweight. Junyoung Park, also not the biggest, tallest middleweight. Both guys, good punching power. A lot more volume from Junyoung Park. But that's kind of where those comparisons end. And at this point, Matt, when you just look at records on a page, which we never want to do, but for Park, I mean, by the fuck, he's fought way better competition.
And that's why this is a bit of a confusing fight. And that's why I fully agree with how you set this video up. Joseph Holmes is still trying to figure it out right now. We don't really know what his specialty is, what's going to get him to the top 15. We know what his specialty is.
I think I know what his specialty is.
But the thing is, Holmes can still improve in so many other ways, even at the things that he does well. For Junyoung Park, like you had mentioned, we already know what he does. He's trying to get into the top 15, and he's not that far away, I don't think. In the middleweight division, like, if you look all right outside of the, like, top 15, if you look good against the top 25 opponent, you're about to fight, like, Sean Strickland in a five-round main event. So, for Junyoung Park, I do think that he is heavily favored, and it does make sense because he is the much more complete fighter, and I do think it's fair to say that this is a difficult fight for Joseph Holmes. Now, maybe he is able to show us something different that we haven't seen from him up until this point. He is still fairly young in the division. He is 27 years old, so I do think that there is room for improvement, but I do heavily favor Junyoung Park on the feet in this matchup. I think he does have the blitzes that you expected out of Amadovsky, but the difference is Amadovsky would throw the blitz, and then there wasn't much to go after that. For Junyoung Park, he can be a steady fighter on the outside. He can be the offensive wrestler. It was something we were talking about before we started filming. Park's a good offensive wrestler, but he can struggle defensively with the takedown. So maybe that's an area that Holmes can take advantage of and really look good with his offensive wrestling. But outside of that one strict game plan, I do favor Junyoung Park in a lot of the areas in MMA.
Well, I mean, for Holmes, you guys know this. You can see it up there on the screen. I mean, he's got a 6-inch height advantage. He's got a 7-inch reach advantage. And when he decides to let his hands go, he has really good pop at the end of his shots. That's the best part for Holmes. Now, outside of the UFC and a couple of fights, even before Contender Series, before he fought on that Looking for a Fight card, he did have decent volume. It started to dry up a little bit, and it's almost below average volume, especially when you compare him to a guy like Junyoung Park. For Park in the UFC, he's 4-2. The losses, one to fluffy Anthony Hernandez,
no
one
shame
to Gregory Rodriguez. That was one of those fight of the night two-rounders where Park looked really good right up until he didn't, and Rodriguez earned the finish win. Now, it feels like a little bit of a, hey, you won your last fight, but Did you really? Because if you look at it for Parks last time out, he beat Eric Anders by split decision. And if you do consider that, MMA decisions, 9 of them had it 29-28 for Anders. 2 of them had it 29-28 for Park. The real story of the fight was the fact that, I mean, Park was minus 200 in that fight. He did decent work when he was on the feet and standing, but he struggled with the takedowns early. He defended all the takedowns in the last round. It was a little bit of an odd decision. But, I mean, other than that, he's number 8 all-time in the middleweight division with strikes landed per minute of 5.14. He's number 6 all-time in the middleweight division with takedown accuracy 4 at 55%. So some decent stats for Park. But you look at this one, I don't think Park's going to work a lot of those takedowns, and I think his volume could be enough to carry him to a win.
I agree 100%. Again, it is a bit of an odd matchup, if we're being completely honest, because Park, I think, could have competitive fights against ranked fighters. Would he beat them? I'm not ready to go that far. Again, we know what his strengths are, we know what his weaknesses are, but he is a steady fighter, like you had mentioned, and I really do think that steadiness can carry him to probably a decision win. Again, I do favor his striking, and maybe he's able to put together enough power punches to get a finish inside the distance, but I feel like the safe pick is Park, and it's probably Park by decision.
We have a look at the odds in the matchup. Holmes open a plus 195. He's about a plus 200 right now. For Jin Young Park, open at a plus 230. Minus 230. Minus 245 on the comeback as it stands on Saturday night. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over, under 80% Park.
I think they'll be under.
You think they'll be under? Oh, wow, right on 80%. Job. So 626 total votes. 80% Park, 81% by decision for the 20% that have Holmes, 41% by decision, 26% by submission, and roughly the difference by knockout. Tapology percentages aren't always accurate. I think Holmes, obviously, as those Tapology voters, they're very astute. They have it. I would think Holmes, if he's going to get the win, probably going to get it by finish, which isn't all that crazy because his takedown abilities are very good. He's slippery on the mat, and he hits with a lot of force. The trouble I have is Holmes can kind of get baited by the barrages and struggle with the volume, and we saw that as the fight wore on against Pickett, although it was on short notice. I like the cardio at a Park, and I love the fact that he just continues to pop in and out, throws a lot of quality strikes. He will throw that jab to the body to give you a different look to come back up top. So I like the variety of strikes and the cardio at a Park. Holmes could surprise, but I do like Park here.
I worry about the size difference, but not the skill set. And I think that's what's really important in this matchup. I do think Jin Young Park is the much more skilled athlete. I think that is what's going to carry him a lot throughout this fight. Not that I don't believe Joseph Holmes can make the improvements, because again, the foundation of his skill set could lead to a lot of improvements and really a lot of different areas in his game. So I agree with you. I think Holmes can have better takedowns. I think the ground and pound could be really effective for him, but I still have Jin Young Park.
Both of us going with the Iron Turtle to get the win out of Korea. It's Jin Young Park. We have some big time fights on this card. At 170 pounds, co-main event, Max Griffin and Tim Means in the main event at 145. Calvin Kattar taking on Arnold Allen. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
A couple of American top teammates, they're battling it out. We have the Pitbull, Andre Arlovski, taking on Pazal, Marcos Rogério de Lima. And it's weird when teammates fight. For Arlovski, I mean, my God, the guy's been fighting forever. His first fight was in 1999 as a professional.
Dadzik or whatever.
Yeah, you're close.
It was Buddy who just knocked out Fyodor's brother.
Fyodor? Were you born over there? Yeah, Vyacheslav Dadzik.
Thank you.
Fyodor?
That's how Ariel Helwani says it. You pronounce everyone's names the right way, so I'm trying to do the same.
Fyodor.
Don't call me out for what you do on a daily basis.
Andre Arlovski take on Marcos Rogério de Lima. And for Arlovski, the last time he fought a current teammate was when he fought Felipe Lins, and he got the decision win there. And if you look at it for Arlovski, since 2020, he's 6-1. Some chintzy decisions have gone his way. But regardless, if you look at it, he has his own little faction in the gym. Marcos Rogério de Lima has a lot of Brazilian fighters in his camp. Augusto Sakai, Marcelo Gomes, chief among them. But for Rogério de Lima, you get two versions of him. You get the guy that goes balls to the wall very quickly. Consider his fight with Ben Rothwell as an example.
Oh my goodness, that guy was scary.
You get the guy that has a good first round and then starts to kind of fall off a cliff as the fight goes on. Consider maybe his last fight against Blagoy Ivanov, even though Rogério de Lima still has a little bit of a say in that fight if you wanted to consider it. But for de Lima, it's been a weird run. He came into the UFC, off of the Ultimate Fighter Brazil Season 3. He loses to Shoeface, you know, as the tournament's going on, but he makes it into the UFC. He fights at light heavyweight. Obviously, the weight issues were a big, big problem.
He was like John Lineker at flyweight. Did he really fight at light heavyweight, or did he just fight a lot of, like, 210-pound catchweights?
Yeah, kind of the old Vince St. Preux issue, but if you do look at it for De Lima, he makes the move up to 265 pounds. He's had some decent fights. He's had some bad fights. He's looking to get back in the win column, but if you do consider it here, let's look at some of the biggest wins for both of these guys. We have a look at Andrei Arlovsky. He's got a win over Tim Sylvia. He also lost to Tim Sylvia twice. Lost his belt to Sylvia, actually. He has a win over Fabrizio Verdum. He has a win over Frank Mir. He has the biggest win of his career by split decision. Biggest win of his career by split decision over Benton Schaus. Benton Schaus, big win right there. Oh, we have a look at De Lima. A win over Paulo Filho when he was 21-1-1. His only loss before that, he fought Chael Sonnen. And then he also has wins over the Wombat, Ben Sassoli, and Big Ben Rothwell for Rogério De Lima. Arlovsky also has a Rothwell win. If I'm not mistaken, that was with Affliction, brother.
What do you want me to tell the fans at this point? You basically have told people everything.
Well, we have a couple of guys who are fighting this weekend. One is still a finisher. One has changed his game and evolved into a guy who can win some decisions.
It's weird that Andrei Arlovsky has just become heavyweight Joanne Wood, because that's all he is at this point. I've said this a long time about Joanne, formerly Calderwood, now Wood. It's, hey, what's the best fight Joanne Calderwood could get into? What's the best fight Joanne Wood can get into? Probably a split decision win. You know, it's going to be a lot of 50-50 exchanges. She'll get the clinch, get those elbows in. She'll get taken down a few times. Like, you know, all of her fights are normally going to end very close. And for Arlovsky, it really has been the same thing in his recent tenure of fights. He has very good volume. He has very good footwork. He has great cardio for a heavyweight who is 43 years of age. Normally, we say power ages very well, which is the truth for the majority of athletes. But Arlovsky now does not rely on his power. He relies on his footwork, his technique, his output, which is really interesting, and that's why this fight's so difficult to predict. I was rummaging through my pocket to see if I could find a quarter, because that's how I feel about this fight. De Lima gets an early stoppage, or Arlovsky looks good and schools him and puts on another one of those, like, y'all must have forgot, get off my lawn performances. Now, the weird thing is, De Lima has been around for a lot longer than people probably assume. He was a longtime fighter he's just been around for a while in the UFC, between light heavyweight and heavyweight, and he does have some decent and respectable wins, like you would brought up. And I could see a world where De Lima goes out there, blitzes Arlovsky very similar to how he did against Ben Rothwell, because that's the thing. I vividly remember both of us sitting here saying, hey, Ben Rothwell doesn't get knocked out.
Hasn't been knocked out since he fought Cain Velasquez.
And that was a long time ago. Like, yeah, JDS beat the shit out of him, but he hadn't been, like, dropped or knocked out in a very long time. De Lima's only chance is to knock him out fast. And
Marcus Rogério De Lima fights like if he thought Jungle Juice was a good idea in college or university. You're going to sleep pretty quickly if you go for it.
Oh, I was going to say, Rogério De Lima fights like you just drank 12-4 Locos. He goes for it, but there's not a lot after the initial rush, and you're probably going to go to the hospital afterwards. Now, for Arlovsky, maybe he can use that dynamic movement that we have seen, because that's the thing that does differentiate him from Ben Rothwell. Yes, Rothwell might be more durable, but he's also much more stationary, and he's much more available to be hit by that big power. So, you are probably going to get one or two big clean shots in before we finally realize how durable Rothwell is. For Arlovsky, we don't really know where his chin is at this stage of his career, because he has suffered so many knockout losses, and I know you can look at his recent string of success and think, okay, maybe his chin has come back, but I gotta be honest. It's like when Trae Young made the conference finals. I told my friends, yeah, I think Trae Young's good. I didn't believe a damn word I said to them, and I still don't believe it now. With Arlovsky, I still don't think he can stand up to the power of De Lima. I don't think that's a hot take by any means. It's just, can he avoid the power of De Lima? I think that's the more important question.
And we've seen it for Arlovsky. Like I said, since 2020, 6-1, which is absolutely wild. He's beaten Bozer, Felipe Vandera, and Collier. Those are all really tricky decision wins. I thought the Jake Collier decision was one of the worst I've ever seen, and I still do at this point, even worse than Jan
Rosomali. But it feels like he's been a in 10 straight fights that could go either way completely.
I mean, Michael Bell scored that one 30-27, and then we also had Douglas Crosby and Sal D'Amato. They had it 29-28 for Arlovski. But if you do consider it for Arlovski, still throws a decent level of volume. Yeah. It's not going to knock your socks off, but it's still decent. Cardio still holds up, in and out with his footwork, good side to side. Takedown defense can be an issue at times. Tom Aspinall was able to pop up top and then get the takedown to take his back.
A little different.
He did, and Rogério de Lima could. I mean, you look at De Lima's fight against Maurice Green as a good example. Took him down easily, held him down for 14 minutes in that fight. You look at the odds. De Lima open minus 130, minus 200 right now. For Arlovski, open plus 110, plus 160. We have a look at the Tapology vote, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 70% De Lima.
I think it'll be under.
You think it's going to be under? Oh, it's
six. It is. Let's go.
662 total votes. 70% Arlovski.
Right on the dot.
91% by decision for Arlovski. For the 30% that have De Lima, 70% by knockout. So, Matt, the fans have Arlovski, but the betting community continues to side with De Lima. Who do you have in this matchup?
I feel conflicted because there's fighters that I feel like I have a good read on. Like you had brought up, like Chase Hooper, I never thought I had a good read on him, but I guess I picked a lot of his fights right. I feel like I get every Arlovski fight wrong.
I do.
Even if I do get it right, though, there's sometimes you get a pick right on this channel, but you feel dirty about it. I can admit this 100%. You'll think, oh, I got the win, but the fight didn't go a single way that I thought it was going to go, and I got most of like the actual content of the fight wrong. For Arlovski, I feel like that a lot, but I think he's going to get knocked out in this fight. I really do. I think De Lima's going to hit him with one of those big bursts. I think he's going to find his chin. I think he's going to knock him out. It's nothing against this late career resurgence of Arlovski. It's kind of wild he's been able to keep it going this long. I vividly remember being in grade 12 in 2016, and people were counting Andrei Arlovski out at that stage of his career. But I think it's probably up, and that's why I have De Lima.
I do not like the cardio of Marco Sergio De Lima
at all.
After one round, he looks completely gassed. So unless he gets the finish in the first round, I think Arlovski cruises to a decision win in this one. He's good in and out. He's decent with takedown defense in general. We'll see if De Lima and that other faction from American Top Team is able to figure out Arlovski at this stage. But we're split on the pick. Matt going with Pizzau, De Lima. I'm going with the Pitbull, Andrei Arlovski, to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section. Really eager to hear from you on this one because I can see a lot of people being split on the pick. We have some big-time fights left on this card. Calvin Kattar taking on Arnold Allen in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
The middleweight finishers square off coming up this weekend. We have no hype Phil Hawes, who must have lost the Rashad Evans in his corner because the nickname came out all of a sudden, and Rashad was always singing his praises. Hawes taking on Roman Dolidze out of Georgia. A couple of guys that love to finish fights and a couple of guys that are no slouches on the ground, especially when we're talking about Roman Dolidze, whose background, it started in Sambo, a little bit in Jiu-Jitsu, and then really his grappling is so well-rounded. That's what got him to the dance. But when you consider it for Dolidze, former FILA World Grappling Champion, ADCC Asian Oceania Champion as well. And Dolidze, if you do watch him fight, especially when he just started off his UFC tenure, he was really hot and heavy on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
He was big at trying to go for leg locks, looking at Eric Nixick going, you like this, coach? And then trying to finish his fights up until he ended up fighting Trevin Giles. And if you do look at it for Dolidze, first pro fight is at heavyweight, after that at light heavyweight. And if you do look at it, like even at ADCC, he was competing at 99 kgs, so about 218 pounds. Dolidze makes that middleweight debut against Giles. Can't figure out that power jab. So he has to really try and reinvent it a little bit. His next two fights, he beats the blown-up welterweight, Laureano Staropoli. And then his last time out, fights Kyle Daukaus in a fight that I didn't think Dolidze was going to win, especially by that knee that he threw. But my God, did he look good, and he got an extra 50K for that performance.
And this is a weird thing about this fight. Both fighters are 4-1 in their last five, but this does feel like an oddly important matchup to be buried so far deep on the card because both guys have had, I would say, high ceilings placed on them by the MMA community, and not that I don't believe either guy could eventually get into the rankings, but it does feel like it's okay. One fighter's going to be able to maybe achieve that as a ceiling, but the other one's probably going to get cut to the wayside as a result. Now, maybe using the term cut is a little bit harsh by me, but
I think they say left by the wayside.
Left by the wayside, but you get the idea. The loser of this fight is going to get very much left off track, whereas the winner, I think, still has the possibility to get a number next to their name. We talked about the middleweight division, and now it is a little bit shallow compared to a lot of the other divisions in the UFC, especially the lighter ones. We talk about bantamweight, really all the way up to welterweight. That's kind of like the cream of the crop. I think there's a world where Dolidze could go out there and really use his offensive wrestling. We saw how effective he is with his offensive strikes in the clinch the last time out against Kyle Daukaus, and I think that's where he can have success, but I think range is going to be important in this fight. I think the long-range Phil Haas has much more technical boxing. He has a steadier jab, better straight punches as well. I think that's where Haas can have success, but the weird thing about it is, on the inside, I favor Dolidze with the striking. I like both guys grappling, though, and I really will be interested to see whose grappling is going to win out, because we know Phil Haas is a very good offensive wrestler, but with Romain Dolidze, it's a very unique style of grappling. He much prefers upper body throws, hip tosses, and that sort of style of grappling, so I'm very interested to see how his judo style of takedown is going to mesh against Phil Haas' more traditional takedown.
I mean, for Phil Haas, he was a JUCO national champion when he wrestled at Iowa Central, and then he ended up going to D1 Iowa State, and if you do look at it for Haas, he was on the Ultimate Fighter as long ago as Tough 23. He ended up losing to the eventual champ of that season, Andrew Sanchez. He loses on World Series of Fighting to eventual millionaire Luis Taylor, who was in the corner of Bilal Muhammad just last weekend. So Luis Taylor gets the shouts, but he loses that fight, takes about a year off. They have him on Dana White's Contender Series Season 1. That was Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series. He loses by finish to Julian Marquez, takes some more time off, has some fights here and there, comes into the UFC, and it's been weird. Because, I mean, you're winning fights, you're beating Jacob Malkoon very quickly, walking him down, knocking him out. He fights Nassourdine Imavov, out-wrestles him, but it was a close fight, wins by majority decision. He fights Kyle Daukaus and wrestles him pillar to post and look great in that one. Loses to Chris Curtis in a fight where he's having tons of success, and then Curtis just picks it up.
Yeah, big power.
Not as great at snapping with one hand as I am the other, but when I snap with both of them, I can get it. And then his last time out, he fought Deron Wynn. And Matt, my question to you, have you ever seen a guy beat the fuck out of another guy like that for two rounds before the referee decided no mas?
Saw Gerald Meerschaert fight Deron Wynn. That's the problem. Yes, you're right, it was an impressive performance, but it was against Deron Wynn,
okay,
of all people.
So we reel it in, we take that fishing rod and throw the fly out there, and we'll say this. The things that I liked out of Phil Haas in that matchup, he worked his jab. His best weapon in that fight was either the step in like a Paul Felder elbow,
nice.
Or he was mixing them in that way, and he was using it from both stances and both elbows. And I did like to see that out of Haas. And we've seen this camp out of Killcliffe FC, so many good middleweights in that gym to get ready for a fight like this. So for Phil Haas, getting ready there, for Romain Dolidze, Extreme Couture, and for Dolidze with his striking, he will throw a jab. He will mix in a little bit of an overhand to close the distance.
He's more hittable, though, when he throws his own strikes, I think.
Little bit more hittable. Obviously, the chin is questionable of Phil Haas, and we've seen that in a lot of his fights. But for Dolidze, the best, or when he's at his best when he's striking, well, it was outside of the UFC, was a former WWFC light heavyweight champ. When he fought Pasternak in that fight, he was just throwing spin and stuff. He was going wild with the striking. He was having tons of success. And you could say, well, Craig, it's WWFC. And I'd say, yeah. I understand that. It's not the UFC. But for Dolidze, we saw him have a lot of success there. I'm sure Extreme Couture, Eric Nixick, they're saying just clean it up 100%. A little bit. What do I know? I'm behind this computer screen. So I do look at this fight as, again, like you said, a very important fight. The big trouble I have when I'm trying to make a pick in this one, and trust me, it is difficult here. Phil Haas, historically in the UFC, is a sample size. 5.68 significant strikes per minute to 3.43 absorbed. So both above UFC average. The absorbed just slightly above average is 3.38 the average. 3.39. It's gone up a tick. For Romain Dolidze, throws 2.43 significant strikes per minute, absorbs 1.45. What Dolidze throws out there traditionally is less than what Haas absorbs, and Dolidze just doesn't throw a lot when he's on the feet, and there are long periods of time where he's at distance against his opponents.
And that's why I 100% agree with the odds. I don't know if you want to bring them up before I want to go on this little spiel.
I mean, Haas opened a plus 115 underdog, minus 170 right now. Dolidze opened a minus 135, plus 140. And I had a lot of confidence in Dolidze coming into the UFC. I thought this guy, like, we're not talking top 15. We're talking top 10. This guy's going on a run at 205.
Is he your Dante Exum?
It's a shallow division. But for me, I just don't know what to think anymore. He looks so good against Kyle Daukaus. And Phil Haas looked really good against Kyle Daukaus, too. Just tales of opposite fights. But I do have a hard time with this.
It is another one of those things that it comes down to, what is your opinion of Kyle Daukaus? Because he was another fighter who, again, had a high ceiling, had high expectations. And they never really came to fruition over time. But I must say, I do agree with where the odds are and with who is favored. Because for Phil Haas, I think he does excel in about two of the three ranges of MMA in this fight. I think the traditional takedowns of Phil Haas are going to give Roman Dolidze trouble. I think Haas has more staying power as this fight continues. I do think that's why he's a little bit more favored in this fight. I think if he can stay connected to Roman Dolidze in the third round, but use his range in the first two, use the jab, use his longer range strikes. I know Dolidze is the bigger guy, so you would immediately assume, okay, he's going to have success at the long range. But when you really do break down their styles, I do think Haas is a much steadier jab, and I think that jab's going to be really important. You bring up that Trevin Giles performance. I think that's a really important one to bring up. Not that Haas is as technical as Giles, because I think Giles is a little bit faster with some of his techniques on the hands, but Haas hits a whole hell of a lot harder, and he's especially a lot more right-hand dominant when he does land that powerful right hand. So I think there is a good pathway for Phil Haas to win this fight, but I think there's a competitive argument to be made for either athlete to win this fight, although my pick is going to be with Phil Haas.
Matt, giving out the pick before we look at the Tapology votes all over the place. Well, let's look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us is there
they
are.
You.
I'm going to say over under 70% Phil Haas.
I think it'll be under.
You think it's going to be under? It is under. 636 total votes. 64% Haas, 52% by decision, 44% by knockout. For the 36% that have Dolidze, 35% by decision, 52% by knockout. I don't know why there aren't more people that have Dolidze to win by submission. Lewis Taylor did it all those years ago. Dolidze would be a likely candidate there. And I would think if Dolidze wins, he could get it done in all three different ranges. Could get it done by decision, submission, or knockout. And you might say, well, Craig, you're not wrong if you pick one of those. Well, I know that. But if I am looking at this fight, Matt, I do like Haas. I like the mix of the combinations. I don't love the chin. Like we've established this in many of his fights. But we have seen him wrestle continuously throughout his fights and it not totally eat away at his gas tank. Where for Dolidze, we saw him even in the John Allen fight kind of struggle with it. And I think at 185, it's a little bit more of a grind for Dolidze. Both guys heavily muscled. Phil Haas, the other thing that I want to say, as much as he does strike, he does not throw leg kicks, like,
right,
at all.
Very boxing.
He has in certain fights, but Haas isn't a guy that's big behind the leg kicks. Even though he has big thighs, it's more to get that leverage and that power into his takedowns. Dolidze, like, couple of guys, tree trunks for legs. But for me, I like Haas a little bit more in this matchup. But if you made a compelling argument for Roman Dolidze, I'm here to listen to you.
And again, like I said, I think this is a very fun fight lower on the card. Again, it's a very important fight for both athletes. This is one of those like baseball games midway through the season where if you don't follow that team, like I'm a big Yankees fan, so life's been tough the past week, but it's one of those games where it's like, okay, it's a pennant race. If you're not a diehard fan of that team, you might not realize the significance that it does hold on the standings overall. But I think this fight's very similar to that. I think Haas and Dolidze both have the potential to be one of those floaters in the top 15. A guy who could be number 14, number 15, could be in the rankings one week. You check the next week and all of a sudden they have two guys who have won a little bit more recently in there. But you get the idea. Two very talented fighters in their own right. But I agree with you. I also have Phil Haas.
Well, it was going with no hype. I don't like the nickname.
I don't either.
I like his, what is it, Friday or whatever on his Instagram where he has, like, completely random people over there doing crazy stuff. So make sure you check out Phil Haas' Instagram game. What a big card we have. Only 9 fights as of Sunday night. So, man, if there's any changes throughout the week, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time light heavyweight matchup coming up this weekend. We have a couple of rollers. High rollers, baby. You think April Wine fans love this fight? We have the Hanyok, Dustin Jacoby, and the man formerly known as the Warhorse, Khalil Roundtree Jr. It's a very fun fight at light heavyweight between a couple of premier strikers. You know Dustin Jacoby got up as high as number 2 in the world with Glory Kickboxing. His run to kick off his UFC career way back when in 2011 included losses to Clifford Starks and Chris Camozzi. But for Jacoby, He just rebranded himself, rebuilt himself, and in the UFC on this current run, he's what, 6-0-1? And to me, it feels weird because he's ranked 13th in a division, and they're not giving him ranked opponents. Do you figure that ranked guys don't want to sign that contract when it slid across the page?
I think that might be the case, and I was going to give it back to you really quick, but I'm really glad that we went down this road, because Dustin Jacoby is very unique for a light heavyweight, or even a heavyweight fighter, because once you do start to get into the heavier weight classes, let's all just be very honest with ourselves, it does get a little bit less technical, right? Get a little bit more wild, everybody has more power. You know who didn't get less technical, though, the bigger they got? Dustin Jacoby. That's why I do think he's a difficult matchup for a lot of these other ranked fighters. He has good but not great takedown defense. He definitely offers resistance, though, on the feet with the takedown attempt. And on the feet, he has good striking defense. He definitely has great striking offense. You bring up his glory accolades, but just watching his fights, he's good defensively. He has very high hands. He can check leg kicks, can even check body kicks. He's really good at bringing his knees high up, too, to meet his elbow to kind of create that barrier to defend kicks. And I think that's a very important thing when you're fighting a guy like Khalil Roundtree, but this is kind of where I want to hand it back to you, and this is how I look at this fight. Roundtree might have a little bit more power. He might be
a lot more.
You're right. He's more explosive. He hits harder. He's probably a little bit faster too with his hand speed. But my problem is, Roundtree, over time, he used to be a boxer. Think about his fight against Tyson Pedro all the way back when. Drops Pedro on the feet with a punch. Pedro ends up submitting him, but still, that was the original Khalil Roundtree. He was primarily a boxer. Over time, Khalil Roundtree has learned to fight like Dustin Jacoby. He's more of a Muay Thai fighter. He's developed more of that Muay Thai stance, more of that Muay Thai style. Do you think sort of the late career resurgence of him learning a lot of those skills that Jacoby has just sort of had as his foundation, will that be enough to make this fight competitive on the feet? Because I do think Jacoby is a little bit more technical, even though a lot of people, when they think Roundtree, and especially this new, more recent Roundtree, they think about his appearances on the Joe Rogan podcast, which is wild because it's Khalil Roundtree, but still, he has taken a crazy...
It's got a wild life story.
He does, and he has had a very insane career evolution because he does not look like the fighter that he once was way back in the day. Please go ahead and watch some of those older fights because his movement has improved. He's a much more fleet of foot. I just think the way that he has developed his skill set is going to make this a tough matchup against Jacoby, who fights in a similar way, but I think he's tighter defensively.
Yeah, I think with Khalil, you look at it, I mean, he started off his UFC tenure off the Ultimate Fighter season 23. We just mentioned that.
Those body kicks on the ground.
But if you do, yeah, well, that's where I'm going with it. For Roundtree, you look at it, he starts off 4-4. He did have that time over with Tiger Muay Thai, reinvented himself. I mean, he looked amazing in that fight against Eric Anders, and it's like, wow, this guy's a completely different fighter. Then he takes on Yuan Kutsalaba, and he gets knocked out, elbows and mount. Like, he took a really long time off. And if you told me 2 years ago, you went, hey guys, Khalil Roundtree and Dustin Jacoby are going to fight in the UFC, I would have said, you're fucking crazy. Because for Jacoby, he was just coming back into the UFC. So 2 years ago, he hadn't even had his debut. He comes back on the big UFC card. It was Fight Night Hall versus Silva. He gets a win, and he's off to the races. And again, 6-0-1. And that 0-1, the one being the draw, or split decision, split draw, rather, it was a 10-8 first round for Kutsalaba. And then Jacoby rallied back, and Kutsalaba got tired. So if you're playing MMA math, one loss, badly. One had a draw, which is better. But for Roundtree, loses that fight to Kutsalaba, takes a long time off, goes out there, loses again to Marcin Prakniaw.
It was a bad performance.
Round one didn't look terrible. Round two, round three didn't really do much. And then if you look at the last two fights, Roundtree aligned himself with Syndicate, and he looked like the warhorse again. He really did. I mean, his second to last fight, he takes on Modestus Bukauskas. Very low volume in that fight. Now, Roundtree busted up the nose of Bukauskas in the first round. He wins that round. Second round, he throws that kick to the oblique kick, and it just drops Bukauskas, and the fight's over. And they mentioned it on the broadcast, just like Rampage against Jon Jones. Nobody likes those strikes. Oh, you shouldn't throw them.
It's legal.
It's legal, so I'm cool with it.
It was gross, though, for all being honest. Like, oblique kicks are normally at the front of the knee, so it hyperextends it. He hit him at the side of the knee, and you basically just watched him Derrick Rose another
man. I mean, he shut her down and sent him back to Cage Warriors. So for Khalil, his next time out, he fights Carl Robertson. And we've said things about Carl on the channel. We might not be the biggest fans of him, but we reference him a lot. Khalil Roundtree beat the fuck out of him, and he dropped him twice. I mean, he was what?
But
let me talk you through it. I mean, he's absolutely just landing fuck you moves. drops him a knee, gets into the clinch, drops him again. And once Carl's down and holding on for dear life, he throws the old soccer kick to the body. He just completely dismantled him. So for Carl, had a good run in glory. It was all right.
Would you agree with me, though? Dustin Jacoby would have done the exact same thing.
Yeah, but I mean, what I do like out of the last two performances, specifically for Khalil Roundtree Jr., it's the fact that, again, he's gotten back to what got him that win over Eric Anders. He's aligned himself with Syndicate. You know John Wood's a really good coach. You know they've really thrown something, a program together 100%. That's worked for Roundtree. And to get back to the original question, it's that Muay Thai stance, that high front leg from Roundtree. Jacoby's got a decent leg kick. Roundtree can just keep that Thai stance, that front leg moving, so it kind of negates the leg kick from Jacoby, and it opens up that big time lead hook for Roundtree. That's something that could land against Jacoby. But for Jacoby's last time out against Daun Jung, didn't think Jacoby was going to win that fight. Jung was winning that fight right up until the end. His boxing was good, it was crisp, he was landing with good accuracy, and then Jacoby lands a check left and a left straight, and then he lands a right cross, and Jung just completely drops. And then I thought, well, this fight's not over. Like, Jacoby walks away. Referee Kevin McDonald's not going to end this one. Jung stands up, walks away. So, you end that fight. So, a great win for Jacoby. He gets a big-time bonus there. It's a really tough fight because you have two primary strikers. I don't expect any grappling in this one. If I did, it would be out of Jacoby, oddly enough. He is the guy that would be more likely 100%. To go for the takedown. But I think you're going to get a really fun fight. And again, Jacoby's 13th. Khalil Roundtree's like your 16th light heavyweight. The next guy's got to get a ranked fighter.
I would effing hope so. I've sworn a lot, so I'll try not to as much. For Jacoby, I just think he's more technical in the fight. And that's the thing. If he's more technical, I don't think there's an argument that he has the better cardio. I obviously he has the much better cardio. Because the thing about Roundtree is, and I agree with you 100%, it does feel like very much a mindset switch with him between his two losses and his two wins, if you look at his previous four fights. But he still hasn't shown that lasting ability, even though he has shown a resurgence in aggression his last two fights. I still think that if he really goes for that finish in the first round against Jacoby, if he doesn't get it, well, Jacoby's still steady in the second round. He can steady in the third round. He throws in combination, and he doesn't put everything behind every punch. You're right. Roundtree does have the better power, but I don't know if he has the better power if Jacoby fought in the same way Roundtree does. Roundtree's more tactical, but he still loads up on a lot of his punches. You can tell he winds up from a long ways away. His kicking technique is much improved, don't get me wrong. But for Jacoby, I just like his lasting ability a lot more, and I think that even if he loses the first round, I think he can win 2 and 3. If Roundtree loses the first round, sorry, I really don't like him in the second or the third round this matchup, and that's why I have Dustin Jacoby.
It is a tricky fight. Matt giving away all the picks before we talk about the odds and the topology votes, like he's never been a part of any of these videos. Jacoby is favored to win this one. He opened a minus 185, minus 170 right now. Roundtree opened at a plus 160, plus 140, so slightly shading towards the man formerly known as the Warhorse. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over, under 65% Jacoby.
I think they'll be over. I think the average fan will be confident in them.
668 total votes. We've got 79% Jacoby, 54% by decision, 38% by knockout. For the 21% that have Roundtree, 83% by knockout. So the fans siding with a Roundtree knockout, I think you're going to get a Jacoby decision win out of this one. His output's higher. Now, his last fight against Daun Jung, it was very low in that first round, right up until he landed the finishing sequence. So it's going to be a feeling out process, I imagine, between these two guys to start the fight out. So it could be a bit of a stalemate in that first round. But Jacoby gets rolling normally as these fights go on. And he's not necessarily known as a big-time finisher. And Daun Jung's not necessarily known as a guy that gets finished. But hey, here we are.
Things
so I like Jacoby in the matchup. But if you really like Roundtree to get the finish, I'm here to listen to your argument on this.
I think it'll be a really fun fight, though, because this is what I do think. I think there might be a feeling out process, but hear me out. Roundtree's best chance to win this fight is in the first round, so I think he's going to come with a really big storm. I think that big storm is going to carry Dustin Jacoby until he can start to get the timing down, until Khalil Roundtree might start to slow down with his own pace. That's when I think Jacoby will start to get his own timing, land his combinations, start landing his own power shots. So I also have Jacoby.
We will see if Roundtree can get his third win in a row, or will Dustin Jacoby make it five, count them five, or you could really consider it a giant win streak if you don't factor in the draw. It's a big time matchup this weekend in a not so loaded light heavyweight division. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big matchups left on this card. Dirty Bird taking on Max Payne Griffin, and in the main event, Calvin Kattar and Arnold Allen. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, it's a Fight Night Pick special. We've got a weird bucket of muscles type of fight. It's Josh Fremm, the former LFA middleweight champion runner-up, taking on the former Ultimate Fighter to be Trayshawn Gore. And why do I say it's a weird bucket of muscles? Well, hey, muscles are cheap in this part of the world. You can get a pound of them for like $2.50 at Sobeys.
I just got into them into the summer. I was like, I'll give these a try, see if they're any good. They're like pretty good.
Mix some like heavy cream with some white wine. You get yourself a good Saturday night with some shallots. But if you do consider it, why do I say it's a weird bucket of muscles? Because if you leave a weird bucket of muscles in your fridge for too long, they go smelly and bad. And if you have a look at this fight, it's not that it's bad or smelly. It's just weird. And when I do break this one down, the first question that I'm going to ask the audience, whether you're in the car, you're on the plane, you're watching on your computer, on your television, your PlayStation, your Xbox, here's my question to you at home, and assess this one, take as much time as you need. Who had more pre-fight hype coming into the UFC?
That's a good question.
I'll let you answer it, Matt. I'll let you speak for the people here.
I'm going to say Trayshawn Gore, and let me give a quick explanation.
Really quick.
He was kind of the uncrowned king of the Ultimate Fighter, a lot of average fans felt. Of course, he missed out on the finale due to a knee injury, and then just sort of got introduced as, hey, we're going to like redo the finale, if you will, and we'll see how it goes. And he has not looked very good ever since.
So for Trayshawn Gore, he was 3-0 outside of the UFC. He ends up on the Ultimate Fighter, beats Ryder Newman by decision, finishes Gilbert Urbina. He's scheduled to take on Brian Battle in that finale, and then he's out due to the knee injury, as you had mentioned. So Urbina steps in and then gets finished by Brian Battle. And for Brian Battle and his ramen hair, that wasn't good enough. So the UFC said, hey, you got to fight Trayshawn Gore. And Battle said, yeah, I'll do it.
Now, to be fair, losing to Brian Battle isn't us writing your obituary like the commentary team was doing for Leon Edwards before he beat Kamaru Usman. I think Brian Battle has proven that he is a good fighter. But the thing is, losing to someone like Brian Battle when you have that much hype behind you is it concerning for some.
And for Battle, he kind of has a problem in a lot of his fights, like Albert Duraev. The striking defense turns into blown up eyeballs. And
for Takashi, dude.
For Trayshawn Gore in that fight, I mean, he had a little bit of success in the second round, but first round, third round, Battle was able to prove it and win out. So for Gore, all of a sudden you're going from 3-0 to 3-1. So then he goes out and fights Cody Brundage. And the other important part about this was in the fight against Battle, the odds were relatively close. In the fight against Cody Brundage, a teammate of Josh Fremm's and also another guy this weekend that's fighting, Dustin Jacoby, all out of Factory X. Brundage in the fight against Gore, Gore's a minus 155 favorite. 67% of 3,767 voters on Tapology had Gore to win that fight. I don't know if we did. Pretty sure we didn't.
I
but
don't remember.
In that matchup, Brundage was able to have some success with the wrestling at the start, and then he stopped, and he decided to box. And the commentary team went, boy, he doesn't look very good. And Brundage is breathing in and out through his mouth because his mouth is open, and you don't really love that, especially in the first round. Gore's walking him down. Landing an occasional leg kick, landing an occasional overhand right, trying to just keep the distance but not landing the jab, just putting that lead hand out there. But for Gore, it ends up being Brundage that closes the distance. He explodes with a right cross, then he gets into mount and knocks him out cold with the ground and pound.
Can I ask you a question about Trayshawn Gore? Because we've been kind of tiptoeing around it, but it is the truth. Is the lack of volume, is the uptick in volume, or is the potential of uptick in volume in Trayshawn Gore, is that the missing link, or is that just one piece of the puzzle? Does he need a lot more than that, or is it as simple as Trayshawn Gore has good foundational skills, which I do agree with, but it's just that is such a big Achilles heel for him that's holding him back from really realizing his potential.
I mentioned this in both of the previous Trayshawn Gore fights, and every time I think about him, I think back to this. I even talked about it this past weekend. We were watching UFC 280. TJ Dillashaw walked into the stadium. Who was behind him? Juan Archuleta, former bantamweight champ with Bellator, and a man with a black, like, fatherly goatee, Tiki Gosen. And Tiki was Trayshawn Gore's coach on The Ultimate Fighter, Team Ortega. And if you watch those fights on The Ultimate Fighter, Tiki, yelled at the top of his lungs for Trayshawn Gore to unload. And when Tiki would yell, Trayshawn Gore would unload. But they're not aligned anymore. And Tiki's not in Trayshawn Gore's corner. And I don't know if that was kind of the thing that Gore needed. But I just haven't seen that aggression. Because when Gore goes with his hands, his combinations are fluid. His power is really good. Trayshawn Gore is a very cerebral fighter. It's just he's been reserved in the two UFC fights. And I wish I've seen a little bit more of him.
This is going to work out perfect. Because you mentioned how he's a cerebral fighter. Trayshawn Gore is the Spencer Dinwiddie of MMA. And let me explain why. When Spencer Dinwiddie's banging threes like he's been doing with the Dallas Mavericks. Because Luka draws a lot of attention. So you get wide open shots. He's a really good player. He can like attack closeouts. He knows what to do. He's a smart guy. Spencer Dinwiddie is, if you don't know. But with Trayshawn Gore, it is the same. It's that one missing part of his game that I think if he does realize that, oh, if I throw more, I will be a better fighter. And I know that's a very simple statement to make, but it really is. You have to take all the skills of MMA and kind of take them into consideration. It's okay, Trayshawn, you can't just throw more volume. I know that if you throw more volume, it's going to open up more holes. It's going to make you more hittable. It might hurt your cardio. Like, there are going to be some takeaways to that, but I do think that one area of his game, if it were to be unlocked, would really help him finally realize his potential. Because, at least for Josh Fremd, yes, we talk about sort of the striking defense, and I think that has been a big issue for him throughout a lot of his career. But for Fremd, at least he throws volume. Like, he's in there to get into a fist fight. He fully realizes what his goal is when he's in a fight. And I think there is a world where Fremd goes in there, has, and I don't think it would necessarily favor him having a fight like this, because I think it would open the door for Gore to land a good counter, but you get the idea. Have one of those car crash type fights. Make it chaotic. Make Gore think about everything that's going on in the fight, and don't let him flow with his skills, and I think Fremd could have a very good game plan in this fight.
I think that's a fight where Gore wins, but if you do look at this one, if we consider it for Josh Fremd, originally he was supposed to fight Trayshawn Gore on July the 9th, and Fremd's out of the fight. Brundage is in on short notice, and Gore's the favorite. So for Fremd, another training camp getting ready for Trayshawn Gore. For Gore, gets back to that original opponent. But I looked at Josh Fremd. He replaced the guy I already mentioned in this video, Albert Duraev, but also Dricus du Plessis. Fremd came in on short notice and fought Anthony Hernandez on 11 days notice back in April, and he got taken down and kind of rinse and repeated in that fight. Now Fluffy's going to do that to pretty well every middleweight. And the other thing that Fremd did well, he flowed in a lot of those instances and went for his own submissions. And in the second round, I thought he looked pretty good. 230-27s and a 29-28. 10 minutes and 45 seconds control time for Fluffy Hernandez. But for Fremd, I walk it back. We go and look at his winning ways. He lost to Gregory Rodriguez in that LFA title fight. It was a middleweight tournament with four guys. So before that fight, he beat Bruno Oliveira that was on Dana White's Contender Series. Finished him. Some of the other wins here. He gets a win over Renato Valente by decision with the LFA. And he beats Joel Bauman over with FAC. That was the opportunity to kind of get into the UFC. It was a looking for a fight card. And for Fremd in that fight, he got blitzed a lot by Bauman. Bauman was only landing power shots. He's landing nice kicks to the body. And as the fight progressed, Fremd was able to kind of work in his fight. But when I look at Fremd and I consider it, I mean, he did wrestle a bit, you know, in high school as he went forward. He's got a decent right hand. He really likes the jab and he throws some decent leg kicks. But I guess where Fremd has kind of a meat and potatoes game, I think if Gore comes into this fight, I mean, he's 3-2. So it's kind of one of those Billy Talent, nothing to lose type of fights. He needs to win or you're 3-3 and you're probably not in the UFC anymore. I think for Gore, it is a fairly winnable fight if he just upticks the aggression and the volume, because I've seen him in fights like that before not struggle with the striking defense, and his ability to land is really there. So this is one of those fights that he could definitely win if he closed that distance with Fremd, because Fremd's a big tall guy that can get, you know, he's a little susceptible to the tall lean back, and so those height and reach advantages are a good thing for Fremd with his jab and his 1-2 when he decides to land it. But when he does the lean back and there's a lot of pressure against him, that's where Gore can win this fight.
That's why untapped potential is like the craziest thing in every single sport. Like, everybody can think back to a player that was on their favorite team that everybody thought was a year away from being the big thing.
I mean, it could be like a Bruno Caboclo.
I was thinking Andrea Bargnani was kind of the big example. But, like, there's players for teams all over. You could probably think of a Canadiens player because I don't know hockey as well. But there's players in every sport where they're a year away from being the guy.
Kyle Chipchura.
There you go. And then next year comes and you're like, oh, they're supposed to be the guy. And then it's, oh, no, they're really a year away. And then they become a year away from being a year away, and you never want to fall into that category. And Trayshawn Gore is slowly falling into that category. So I think an impressive performance against Josh Fram could really get him back on track. But I do find myself siding with the favorite due to the fact that I've seen him have output in fights. And the fact that I have seen him have success, and the one thing that I know Trayshawn Gore traditionally struggles with, makes it really hard for me to pick Gore. Now, I'm kind of willing to get this fight wrong for me to just learn more about Trayshawn Gore moving forward. So I guess we've said this before for fights. This is a, I'm willing to be wrong about you right now so that I can be more right about you in the future. And that's why I'm picking Josh Fremd.
I mean, to me, you have a look at Josh Fremd in the matchup. You consider the odds here. Fremd open a minus 220 favorite, minus 185 right now. Gore open plus 185. He's plus 150 or thereabouts. The odds are closing in. For Gore, we have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, as it is to you. I'm going to say over-under, probably going to side with Fremd just due to the fact that he has a more extensive pro record and he's fought a higher level of competition. So I'll say over-under 75% for Factory X's Fremd in this one.
Under, but it'll be the favorite.
It is over. Wow. 610 total votes. 83% for Josh Fremd, 24% by decision, 64% by knockout for the 17% that have Gore, 31% by decision, 60% by knockout. And Matt, this is where I break out a record that you're not going to think of, and I'm going to pull it off screen.
I'm excited.
Right here, right now. Matt, you could say that Josh Fremd's game is like a record collection, like on I Think You Should Leave. It's a little bit meat and potatoes. I think Josh Fremd's game is a little meat and potatoes. Like,
is that the chick who sings I Think We're Alone Now?
Yeah, I was walking through the subdivision and somebody had a banker's box with free records. You think I'm not going to grab a Tiffany record, I Think We're Alone Now? My mother-in-law thought it was the coolest thing that weekend.
Listen, there doesn't seem to be anyone around.
It's a great tune, and we had a lot of fun that weekend listening to one song and repeat, just picking the needle back up and playing it again. It was funny in Ted, too.
We're weird.
Regardless, Matt, I have Fremd in this fight for this reason only. I could see Trayshawn Gore uptick in volume, nothing to lose, gets the win by finish because Fremd is susceptible to the blitzes. I think with Fremd, it's going to be that X factor, the grappling. And I saw Brian Battle have some success in that area. Gore has really good offensive takedowns, but if you can hold him up against the cage, use that big frame, I think that's going to lend credence to a Fremd win. Both guys on full camp, so I'm eager to see the changes out of both of these guys. I don't love the line on Fremd as almost a 2-1 favorite at all.
Yeah.
So listen, a buyer beware right there. I'd stay away from it as I will with the majority of these fights, but I'm going to pick Fremd for now and we'll see where it lands on question mark kicks, Matt. And we'll see if somebody could ask if it should have been me. Should have been me. A song by Tiffany.
Do you honestly even know the chorus to a single other song of hers other than I Think We're Alone Now?
Not a chance.
Fair enough. I've also got Josh Fremd. Should be a fun fight, though, for as long as it lasts. And again, it's two guys who have a lot of untapped potential, so hopefully we just see something new from both athletes.
Big-time opportunity for both of these guys at middleweight, and it is a very interesting card coming up this weekend. The Dirty Bird, Tim Means, in the co-main event, taking on Max Griffin in the main event, Calvin Kattar and Arnold Allen. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Heavyweight matchup coming up this weekend. We have the UFC debut of Salsa Boy, Waldo Cortez Acosta, making that jump to the ranks, representing the Dominican Republic, taking on Jared Vandera. And for Jared Vandera, he's kind of like one of my favorite bands out there. And I'm going to out myself right now. Oh, you're a hipster. It's kind of like My Morning Jacket. And there's a song on the record called Just Spinning My Wheels. It's the first song. Jared Vandera's lost his last four fights. And you might go, well, they must be to decent fighters, right? Nah, they're all unranked guys. He did lose, of course, to Alexander Romanov, who's now ranked. He lost to Andrei Arlovsky, who's been ranked, a champ in 2005. He lost to Alexei Olenek, who was once ranked highly.
Now an old man.
But not anymore. Not in the UFC anymore. And he lost to Chase Sherman his last time out there in a fight that was relatively competitive, relatively close. It was about one round apiece going into the third round. Vandera was up in the total numbers in the third round, gets hit by a right cross, gets stunned, goes up against the cage, and Mark Smith let Chase Sherman unload everything he had in the finishing sequence, and Jared Vandera got beaten up.
How long ago was that fight again, Craig?
It was hard to watch. Now, Tapology says it was about 3 months ago, so we're going to be specific on this one and make sure that we dot our I's and cross our T's. So for Jared Vandera, his last fight out against Chase Sherman was early July. So
it's, why are we doing this?
It's been a little bit. It's been a little bit since that last fight. But for Vandera, it was a really tough loss all that time ago. Now, he is, of course, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, and he earned that under Tom Galecchio and Big Daddy Joe Stevenson. And he also has high school wrestling in his back pocket. But for Vandera, the grappling wrestling that saw him get to become an UFC world champion at heavyweight
hasn't been there.
He's abandoned it in the UFC, and it hasn't been a big part of his game. And some of these decisions that haven't gone his way have been close. I thought he beat Andre Arlovsky. It was a close decision. He was on his way to beating Chase Sherman until he ended up getting finished. So for Vandera, if he's able to go back to somewhat of the well that he had of wrestling grappling, it could look like what we assumed would happen in Waldo Cortez Acosta's LFA title fight when he took on Thomas Peterson, whose wrestling's very good. But it was Cortez Acosta and his boxing that ended up winning him that fight. So Matt, I'm going to throw it on over to something that a lot of Fight Night Picks fans might not have checked out. We did Dana White's Contender Series previews. For the entire season, we talked a ton about Waldo Cortez Acosta. We're going to throw it back to that Dana White's Contender Series preview of Cortez Acosta, and then we're going to talk about his fight against Danilo Suzarchi. Your next fight at heavyweight, Waldo Cortez Acosta. He's undefeated. He's taking on Danilo Suzart of Life Artes Marcias in Brazil, a main training partner of one former UFC heavyweight, Matt's favorite heavyweight fighter, Carlos Felipe. Taking on the former pro boxer Waldo Cortez Acosta, picked up a big time LFA title in his last time out against Thomas Peterson, the hometown guy. They were booing Cortez Acosta. By the end of it, there were some like golf claps in that one because he was looking really good.
He really was. And that's the thing for Waldo. He could be great, but there is a little part of me that does worry because his power is phenomenal when he's able to land his power shots. It's just the delivery system isn't all the way there yet. You know, if he was able to work his way in with a bit better of a jab, if he had slightly higher volume, then maybe I could see some of those bigger power shots landing at a more consistent basis. But right now, he does feel like a very raw prospect. So I'm very curious to see how he makes out on tomorrow's show to get a better gauge as to where his ceiling really could be.
I will kind of zig to that zag, but when I do focus on a pick for this, a lot of people are kind of pointing it out as we were running through this card. Waldo Cortez Acosta is taking on Danilo Suzart. And when I went down through this one, I hate to be that guy because Cortez Acosta is one of the biggest favorites that's on this card. I mean, if we look at it for the main event, Matt, you made the pick last week. Pfeiffer was the underdog. Chris Duncan's an underdog in his fight, plus 133. Charlie Campbell, minus 159. Cortez Acosta coming in a giant favorite, minus 392. But when I was doing the tape study on all of these different fights, and I wanted to make a pick where, hey, I think I'm going to be right on this one. For Danilo Suzart, you watch this guy fight. He marches forward, occasionally throws a kick, and just clubs his overhand right to close distance. He's the least technical heavyweight fighter that you're going to find. And I understand it's squeaky record, so on and so forth, but I went down through his fights. I mean, listen, neither one of these guys has the best striking defense. Both guys have fairly poor takedown defense. I don't expect either guy to take the other guy down. When I look at it for the man out of the DR, Waldo Cortez Acosta, I mean, much better level of competition than he was beating. Again, combined opponents record for both these guys. For Suzart, 11 and 10 out of the wins. For Waldo Acosta, 43 and 24. If you watch it, I mean, he did have a pro boxing record at 6 and 4, which isn't the sexiest.
I gotta be honest, I didn't really expect that out of him just due to the looping nature of his shots. Normally when we do see people with a boxing background, they're a little bit cleaner, a little bit crisper with their boxing, so I'm surprised to hear that, that's all.
Yeah, when I did look at it for Waldo Cortez Acosta, though, really does like to pump the jab out there, throw a looping right hand, and that's the one where a guy with a straight shot's gonna counter him, or when he's throwing that looping shot, you can go for the level change and take him down. But when I'm focusing on a fighter to try and think, okay, is this guy UFC ready? Obviously, Hamdi Abdelwahab surprised everybody last week because I didn't think he was going to do what he did in his fight. And didn't he look great against Dante Mays? But I think Waldo Cortez Acosta is one of those guys that you drop him in between 25 and 20, somewhere in there. You fight a guy that's unranked, and I think he could have some halfway competitive fights. He's going to have a hard time against, like, 14th-ranked Augusto Sakai is fighting this weekend against unranked.
Of course, a guy on Contender Series would have trouble with Augusto Sakai.
Against unranked Sergey Spivak. But when I do look at it, for Waldo Cortez Acosta, I think he's probably the guy that's going to be able to get it done. And the one big thing, and I think it's going to be an X factor in this fight, yes, Danilo Suzart could club him with one of those overhand rights that he throws. Cesar has poor cardio himself. He throws a lot of single shots, whereas Waldo Cortez Acosta likes to try and throw in more combination. I love the fact that Cortez Acosta throws a leg kick and doesn't have a big reset on it. He keeps his hands in a nice spot, doesn't drop them really low to then get countered. So for me, Waldo Cortez Acosta to get the win, that's my pick for the week. Cortez Acosta did get into some of those boxing exchanges with Cesarchi. He did get hit with a couple of those big right-hand clubs. Didn't look like they fazed him at all. But at the end of the fight, after he gets the finish, Dana White said, big power. I see a lot of things that this guy could work on or definitely needs work on. And then he goes on to say, but he's a heavyweight. We need heavyweights. And that fight that he had was August 2nd. On August 5th, they announced that he was going to be fighting Jared Vander. So big full camps for both these guys. And obviously high hopes for the undefeated former LFA champion, Cortez Acosta.
And that's why I'm almost going to contradict myself, so I'll call myself out for it before I even do it. The thing about Cortez Acosta is I still think he can make improvements as he does age in this division. He's only 31 years old, which sounds old if we're talking about a bantamweight, a featherweight, even a lightweight fighter potentially. But in the heavyweight division, I'm not joking when I say you potentially have another decade of contention in you before you finally do age out of the sport. The last video we just made was for Andre Arlovsky. That man's 43 years old, okay? He's been around the block for a while. Now, on the flip side, Vandera honestly is the younger fighter in this matchup, and you're probably thinking, wow, really? But it's the truth. Vandera always had youth on his side in a lot of these matchups, and I've always kind of thought, okay, Vandera has a good, like I always say, foundational skill set. He can wrestle offensively. He's a well-rounded fighter. We talk about his volume. He doesn't have bad cardio for a heavyweight by any means.
He's a paper-cut type of heavyweight, and what I mean by that, it's death by a thousand cuts with Vandera. He was a bit more of a thunderous puncher against the lower level competition before he came into the UFC, but in the fights that we've seen him in, the Arlovsky fight, the Chase Sherman fight, it's a lot of volume, it's some decent accuracy, he eats some good shots, and we saw that in his fight against Justin Taffa. He landed a lot of good shots. He landed a lot of good leg kicks. It was a fight of the night. But for Vandera, again, he's lost four fights in a row, and he's gotten away from the wrestling that kind of got him to the dance.
And that would have a lot of success in this matchup, because I keep on going back to, can Vandera stand up to the power of Cortez Acosta? Even if he didn't get knocked out 2 months ago, I would have a hard time believing that.
It was back in July.
Sorry, 3 months ago. It wasn't, like, July's not that long ago, guys. Like, okay, but if it's midway through July, then now we're down to
three. It's the start of July.
My whole point is, it wasn't that long ago to get knocked out. I much prefer my fighters who are coming off knockout losses to have a 5, 6, 7 month. Anything over 6 months, I'm normally a lot happier with than a shorter duration, especially when you're fighting a power puncher whose best path to victory is by knockout on the feet. I think Vandera does have the wrestling credentials, but my problem is, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, goodness gracious, then it's probably a duck. Vandera hasn't been that duck in a long time.
Hold on,
he hasn't wrestled.
Are you talking about like Paul Kariya in the 90s? He's a duck. He likes the jersey tuck.
Vandera hasn't been that wrestler in a very long time, and it's very difficult for me to believe that all of a sudden he's going to go back in time to become that fighter that he once was. I think he's going to have a really hard time with not only the physicality of Cortez Acosta, but I don't know if he's going to be able to eat the power punches of him either.
And I mean, for Cortez Acosta, what I do like out of him, he really does draw out a lot of feints to his opponent, and then he lands good counter hooks from either side, and he will mix things up. And we touched on it earlier in the Contender Series breakdown, the fact that he has that pro boxing experience. It's not a great record, but it's still a record.
He's
to
an
have.
Athletic guy, though, for how big he is.
Yeah, exactly. So we have a look at the odds in the matchup. Cortez Acosta, about a minus 220 favorite. Vandera, a plus 170. And I will say this. Vandera was a minus 200 favorite against Chase Sherman his last time out there. I picked Vandera to win fights that he has not won. And again, in the UFC, it hasn't gone all that well. So we have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprised us there to you, but I bet a lot of people are down on Vandera at this point. Even though he's a pretty big favorite his last time out, I'm going to say over under 80% for Waldo Cortez Acosta's UFC debut.
I think it's going to be over.
I think it's going to be over? It's over by a lot. 675 total votes, 92% Cortez Acosta, 88% by knockout for the 8% that have Vandera, 63% by decision. I think if Vandera wins, he's going to beat Waldo Cortez Acosta. He's going to take him down. He's going to submit him. And that's not a hot take. I mean, Vandera, jiu-jitsu black belt, good wrestling pedigree, Team Quest, it's his own gym.
TKO ground and pound, I'll throw that in too. Not necessarily submission, but I agree with you, a ground finish.
Yeah, and that is or was his specialty. And if you're fighting for your job and you're trying to keep your spot, that's how Vandero would win. I think Cortez Acosta can beat him to the punch, though. Utilize that boxing, those strong, strong shots. It was an uppercut right hand that knocked out his opponent his last time out. And I think that's a great shot that he could catch Vandera with on the way in, because Vandera tends to drop his hands a little bit when he walks in. And I think that's going to open up the shots from Cortez Acosta, who can strike well for a heavyweight moving forwards and moving backwards, and he has good movement side to side. That's what I really like out of him.
Our friend Clint has this thing called the Contender Series fade, where he doesn't like to pick fighters making their UFC debut coming off Contender Series, because a lot of the times, it's a bit of a step too far. We talk about this a lot. You have big favorites on Contender Series, guys who are more or less expected to win, and then they fight guys in the UFC. The thing is, normally they don't fight guys who are on 4-fight losing streaks. And think back to the last guy coming off Contender Series who fought someone on a big losing streak. Joe Pyfer made Alan Amadovsky look like he was never an MMA fighter to begin with. That was a very one-sided fight that ended in a brutal knockout. What I mean is, I agree with his point in a large part. This isn't me ragging on Clint by any means, because I do think it is a big step up in competition for a lot of these guys who are big favorites like, in an empty arena.
Cortez Acosta was a minus 435 exactly. When all was said and done against Danilo Cesarchi in that one.
But my big point is, normally I would not pick a guy making their debut in the UFC, but he's fighting someone who has lost 4 straight, who's recently coming off a knockout loss, and Cortez Acosta does have phenomenal knockout power, so that's why I like him in this fight.
We will see if Team Quest's own Jared Vandera can get the win in the matchup. Both of us going with the DR's Waldo Cortez Acosta to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Tim Means is fighting Max Griffin, and I'm down for it. You should tell your friends about it. And in the main event, Calvin Kattar taking on Arnold Allen. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Take your friend Craig's word for it. When this fight comes on, flip the channel. Call your friends. Hit them up on a pager. I don't care what you do. We have a big time fight in the welterweight division. Now, these guys are on the fringes of the rankings. It's the Dirty Bird Tim Means taking on Max Payne Griffin in a possible fight of the night. And if you consider this one, Max Griffin in the UFC, debuted at UFC 202. Tim Means fought at UFC 202. So for Griffin, he loses to Colby Covington. 6-7 in the UFC. His performance bonuses against Sung Kanan knocked him dead. I mean, he looked mean in that fight. He was on that 3-fight win streak that ended his last time out. Tim Means was also on a 3-fight win streak till he fought Kevin Holland his last time out. For Griffin, fight of the night against Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos. Knocked him down the first round. Knocked him down the second round. Didn't win a decision. That doesn't happen very often.
He got lit the fuck up in that third round, though.
He did. Tim Means in the UFC. So if Max Griffin is 6-7, Tim Means is 14-10 with a no contest. And he's got a performance bonus over Diego Lima. He's got a performance bonus against John Howard. And he debuted back in 2012 with the UFC. But for Means, Matt, as fun as the run has been, he still looked good at this advanced stage in his career.
He has, because he's not a guy who's always relied on advanced athleticism to really carry him in his fights. And that's why I do think his skill set has aged quite well. Now, you will not find a single person on the internet who will speak to you as eloquently as I'm about to about Tim Means' career. And I'm going to toot my own horn about this too, because I have a theory about Tim Means, and I'd like you to hear about it. Because we predicted his fights for a good amount of time, but let's be honest, Fight Night Picks was not around for a lot of Tim Means' prime, if you will. He had a very good run in the welterweight division before 2018, the birth of this channel, but we've really only seen the fun action fighter version of Tim Means throughout this late career resurgence that he's had. And I shouldn't even call it a resurgence, just the late career fun stage that he's had. But will you agree with me in this when I say Tim Means wins every fight that you think he's going to win, loses every fight you think he's going to lose, though? And that's the thing. Look at the opponents he's lost to. Nico Price, Daniel Rodriguez, Sergio Moraes, and he probably won that fight. And Bilal Muhammad. I gotta be honest, I thought he won that fight too, even though if they had a rematch today, Bilal Muhammad would beat the brakes off and it wouldn't even be close. But at the time, I thought Tim Means won that fight. My point is, though, Everybody who he's beat, Ricky Rainey, Thiago Alves, Steropoli, Mike Perry, Nicholas Dalby, you can make a really good argument just to friends who don't know anything about the sport that, hey, Tim Means is going to probably win this fight. It just feels like when he does fight those guys who are looking to make their ascension up the rankings, that's when he does struggle at this stage of his career, and that's why I struggle picking this fight. We both wanted this to be a fight of the night on the fight of the night screen, and we always say this when we put a fight on that screen. It's not going to be one-sided. Like, it's on the fight of the night screen. It's probably going to result in a really fun fight. I think this is going to result in a really fun fight, but it's also a fight that I can't definitively say, oh, Tim Means is going to lose it. And when fights get fun, that's when Tim Means excels.
Well, if you want to play Tapology, you want to play MMA math, I'll listen to your arguments. And these guys have fought the same fighters before. They both fought Alex Oliveira. I mean, for Tim Means, there's a loss and a no contest. For Max Griffin,
different versions of the Brazilian Cowboy, if I may say.
There's also a loss. They both fought Mike Perry. Tim Means looked really good against Mike Perry. And in the fight that Max Griffin had, how did that fight go?
Not well for Max Griffin.
Yeah, it was a fun
fight. No wait, it did. Max Griffin beat the brakes off Mike Perry.
Yeah, so there were Mike Perry fights for both of those guys. If you look at it, you can consider it. They both fought Thiago Alves. Tim Means beat him and finished him in the first round. For Max Griffin, he lost by split decision, but 16 voters on MMA Decision scored it for Max Griffin. 2 scored it for Thiago Alves. It was really controversial by the end of it. But when you
it
do
was close, though, to
you,
be fair.
You do consider it at this point of their respective careers. Tim Means been the underdog in some of these recent fights. He fights Laureano Steropoli. He fights Mike Perry. He fights Nicholas Dalby. Wins those fights by decision. He had some back and forth with Kevin Holland in the first round of their fight, but Holland lit him up with the volume and the power. He ends up landing the cross that stuns Tim Means. Then he gets him in the front choke and ends up rolling. Gets the Darce for the finish. For Max Griffin, his last time out against Neil Magny, he drops him early. Magny rallies himself back into it. It's a split decision loss for Max Griffin, but it was really, really close one. Like, it could have gone either way, and people really were split. But when I do look at this matchup, there's actually some comparables that are fairly recent for both of these guys, and trying to break this one down. For me, Tim Means, the fight that he had against Sabaho Masi, I think that's a little bit of one.
Oh, my God.
The fight that he had against Thiago Alves as well, just body type-wise, fight style-wise, where they're at in their careers, I think Max Griffin matches up that way. And for Max Griffin, I had his fight against maybe Mike Perry. Maybe that's the way that a guy like Tim Means matches up. Like, Perry's going to walk you down, throw volume, throw power. And that's how Tim Means can fight, too. But I guess stances is kind of a difference there, too.
I think if you want to break it down the most basic of terms, they both have a lot of similarities in their striking style. Both very boxing heavy. Means does like to throw a lot of elbows when he gets in close, though. It's something he's very well known for. Likes the clinch, likes the tie elbows. Will do sort of a single collar tie and then throw elbows with the other hand. It's a very effective maneuver that he's had throughout his career. And it's not something that's faded as he got older. Remember Jose Aldo and the leg kicks? It was always Jose Aldo and the leg kicks. But as he got older, he kind of got away from those. We see that happen a lot in MMA. Fighters will change as they get older. But for the most part, Tim Means doesn't fight in a different way than he did when he was younger. Like, he's going to struggle with grappling defense. He's going to struggle with takedown defense. His initial takedown defense, I think, is solid. I think when he gets into some of those chain wrestling engagements, that's when he can struggle. His striking, very good when it's volume-oriented. He has deceiving power, I think, because you look at a 40-year-old who, again, looks like
any... 38.
Sorry. A borderline 40-year-old who Tim Means looks like any guy walking down the street. There's nothing that makes him exceptional. The thing is, he's really dedicated, has crazy cardio,
high school
really good
wrestling
chin.
Coach.
High school wrestling coach will not offensively wrestle a lot in his fights. Will use the offensive wrestling. He's, again, we talk about this a lot. Guys who are good offensively with the wrestling but struggle defensively with the wrestling. Tim Means is cut from that cloth, but it's just not a big part of his game either way, so I wouldn't expect a takedown attempt from him. I think Griffin's the more likely to go for a takedown, and I wouldn't be surprised that if Griffin's really struggling in some of those clinch exchanges in with some of those elbows of Means, look for him to duck under and maybe try and take this fight to the mat. Where Griffin, I don't know if he has a grappling advantage. I know we've seen Tim Means get out grappled, but I think these guys are on quite equal footing with where their jiu-jitsu is overall. Again, I favor Griffin with the overall wrestling, so it may be better with the grappling because he'll end up in the top position. But this is an underdog pick that I find very tempting. I feel like when people look at this fight, and I feel like this is why the odds are set the way they are, when people think about this fight, it's, oh, Max Griffin's on the come up, and Tim Means has already been there and done that. But when you really think about both guys' careers, I really think they're in similar positions. This fight, to me, we normally say this when it's a prospect getting a big win. It's, hey, a win might be the worst thing for them. Will you agree with me when I say
no.
this? Hear me out. A win isn't a bad thing for them. But a win puts them in a bad situation, which is you're probably fighting a top prospect your next time out. I think the winner of this has enough notoriety to go against like an Ian Gary, a Jack Della Maddalena, and I think that's how the UFC is trying to set it up.
I think the winner gets like a Trinaldo Muslim Salikov type, because for Max Griffin, his last time out, he fights Neil Magny, looks really good early on, and then he just about gets 10-8 in the third round. For Tim Means, he got that kind of big name his last time out off the win streak fighting Kevin Holland. Did well at the start, and then Holland's pressure, his volume, and his power ultimately won out. Is Holland retired? I don't know. But when I look at this matchup, Matt, I'll say this before I mention the odds.
Wonder Boys.
Max Griffin has the perfect opportunity for himself in a training partner. Now, he's Marinoble's martial arts. He's MMA gold. He's Team Alpha Male. For Max Griffin, his main training partner is Anthony Hernandez. So a perfect guy to get ready for that ground game. Griffin's boxing's a lot different than Tim Means. Tim Means is going to come at you with like odd angle shots, the elbows, the clinch work, the tie style.
When he goes downhill, though, it's nice.
But for Max Griffin, you talk about him going downhill. He keeps his head and chin tucked a little bit, and then he walks forward and throws boxing combinations, and it's kind of meat and potatoes, but it's not something that you see all the time just based off his stance. He's got a really nice body kick too, and his punches to the body are very, very good and efficient. So I like Griffin. I don't love his second rounds. Sometimes third rounds are great. Sometimes they're Neil Magny third rounds and they're not very good.
And that's why this is such a fun fight though. Again, you can make a compelling argument for either guy to win by knockout, submission, or decision in any single round of the fight. And that's what always makes a really fun fight.
The odds in this one, Griffin is the favorite coming up. He's about a minus 180 favorite. For Tim Means, plus 150 in the underdog. I have no idea where these topology votes are going to be. So they're always a surprise to us, there to you. Matt, I feel like you had an early lean. I think they're going to be close. I'm going to say over under 57.5% Max Griffin, because I don't know if they're going to be 60.
I think they're going to be over.
I think they're going to be over. All their way over. So 668 total votes. We got 74% Griffin, 71% by decision, 25% by knockout. For the 26% that have Means, 77% by decision. Means trying to come through in the underdog spot yet again. Matt, do you have the Dirty Bird to win? Is there some inherent bias regardless?
No, we brought up the Mike Perry comparable a lot for both guys. Similar opponent for both these guys. But I think when you look at the Mike Perry fight and the Mike Perry performance that both these men had, Mike Perry fights a lot more like Max Griffin than he does Tim Means. There's no argument towards that at all. Mike Perry and Max Griffin almost fight in the exact same manner. They are boxing heavy fighters who do not throw kicks, who go for offensive takedowns, who struggle defensively with their takedowns. If you just want to look at like the archetype of the fighter, I would say they're almost carbon copies of each other. Tim Means and his volume really gave Mike Perry trouble, and I think his volume is going to give Max Griffin trouble too, and this is why. I think Griffin will have success in some of the boxing engagements here and there throughout this fight, but the thing about Tim Means is that even though he is 38 years old, I wanted to put 40 on him, but you corrected me, he's only 38. He still does have good cardio for this stage of his career. That's an impressive thing to see from a guy who is pushing 40 years of age in a division that's not really known for its silver foxes, if you will. So for Tim Means, I do like the fact he's always represented the non-Jackson Wink gym in
Fit
New Mexico.
NHB.
I was just about to say Fit NHB. There's a middle-aged woman who works his corner, who's his head coach. I forget her name, but they've done a really good job with Tim Means. And I think this is going to be a great fight. This is a fight for the fans. I think it's going to have knockdowns on either side. The fact that I'm saying that thinks that it's going to be a pretty damn close fight, but I do like the overall output out of Tim Means. And for a slight underdog price, I don't hate the pick.
I like the storm of Max Griffin, and it just continues and it continues, and once he starts to roll and he figures out his distance, that's when Max Griffin's really, really dangerous. Look at his fight against Ramiz Brahimi. He's hitting him into that ear, he's busting it up, getting the win there. Sung Kanun, he finishes him. Griffin was on a great roll, takes on a ranked opponent in Neil Magny, loses that fight. Tim Means fights a future rank guy in Kevin Holland, loses that fight, and when he's rankings adjacent, he's able to win out some of these matchups. But for me, I think Max Griffin, even though he's about a month away from his 37th birthday, so both guys age-wise fairly similar, Griffin's the guy that I'm going to side with in this one, because again, if you look at the numbers on a page, Means historically has fought with more volume. Means 14-10 with a no contest in the UFC. Max Griffin 6-7. I like Max Griffin a little bit more here, and I like what I've seen in some of these fights where they haven't been necessarily turning away the Young Bucks and the prospects, but I just consider it a little bit more for Griffin.
Disagree with anything on your pick, but I feel really strongly about this. I'm not going to lie. I really do think the winner of this is going to get fed to one of those next-tier prospects. I understand the Trinaldo fight would be a really fun fight. It's a fight for the fans, but I think it's tough to give Trinaldo somebody coming off a loss in a really high-profile fight, and I really do think the winner of this has a big enough name because they're both known as action fighters, right? You're going to pay, maybe not pay to watch either one of these guys fight, but you get the idea. You're going to get excited for the fights that these guys are involved in, and I really do think that the winner of this fight, no matter who it is, whether it is Max Griffin like you said or Tim Means like I think the winner of this is going to get either a Gary or a Madalena next.
We're split on the pick. Matt going with the Dirty Bird, Tim Means. I'm going with Max Payne Griffin. Main event. Cater taking on Allen. It's a big time featherweight matchup that you're not going to want to miss. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
And a big time main event coming up this weekend. It's featherweight fireworks. As always, one half your host and duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen, respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. We have the New England Cartel's own Calvin Kattar looking to put a tricky split decision loss in yet another main event. His last time out to Josh Emmett in the rearview mirror, taking on a surging Arnold Allen. And for Arnold Allen, 11 fight win streak on the line. He's undefeated in the UFC. Just picked up a big first round finish his last time out against one Dan Hooker. So a great win for Arnold Allen. Kattar is coming into his fifth main event in a row. He's gone 2-2 in those last four main events. Obviously, a loss to Max Holloway and Josh Emmett, as we had mentioned. And if you look at the wins that he has, one over Dan Ige, beat him pillar to post, one over Giga Chikadze.
Beat him pillar to post.
Beat him pillar to post as well. And his other main event that he has on his record, a three-rounder against a retired striker, Zabit Magomed Sharipov, a fight that Kattar was rallying back in. Everybody loved that third round for him. But regardless, for Kattar, he's been such an interesting guy in this featherweight division. It almost seems like he kind of came out of nowhere at a certain point. And the funniest thing that I find and I found when I went to look at Kattar and all of his fights in the UFC, debuted against Andre Feely, was a minus 300 underdog, wins that fight, plus 180 underdog, UFC 220 at home against Shane Burgos, wins as an underdog, loses to Renato Moicano, they were about even in the odds, beats Chris Fishgold, Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, minus 230 favorite, he was a minus 160 when he took on Ricardo Lamas, he beat him by finish, loses to Zabit, he's an underdog, beats Stevens as a big favorite, beats Ige as a favorite, big favorite. Loses to Holloway as an underdog. Beats Chikadze, I've struggled with that one, as a plus 200 underdog. And loses to Josh Emmett as a minus 240 favorite. He's all over the map in terms of his odds, and it seems like people have a hard time capping him, let alone finding his standing in this division.
And I think that's because he does have a very foundational and basic skill set. Like, Calvin Kattar doesn't do anything that really wows you. He's really good at a lot of different areas of MMA, but again, I always bring up the Yair Rodriguez example. Like, Yair Rodriguez does stuff in a cage that you sit there at home and you go, okay, there's no chance in this lifetime I'm ever going to be able to pull off just the degree of athleticism he's able to demonstrate with some of his techniques. And this isn't me slagging Calvin Kattar at all, but Calvin Kattar doesn't do anything that you sit there and think, I couldn't do that. But the thing is, to be one of the all-time greats, you've got to be really good at the basics. And that's what everybody's good at, the basics. And there has to be something said for Calvin Kattar, who really has found a way to perfect some of the basics in his boxing technique. But the thing is, we have seen him get behind against some of the people who are kind of all-time top tier, if you will. Guys like Max Holloway, of course, is one of the best strikers of all time. And I guess this is less analysis, and this is me kind of handing it off to you and more opening it up as a discussion. Is Calvin Kattar right now kind of the Derek Brunson of this division? Is he a guy who, if you beat Calvin Kattar, great things are going to happen to you in your career? You're going to fight for a belt, or you're going to be in a title eliminator, something of that degree. But if Calvin Kattar beats you, then you're going to be fighting ranked opponents for a little while. You might have 2-3 fights in the top 15 before you really do get another bite at that apple. Because I think there's a world where Calvin Kattar is a really competitive fight to everybody in the top 5, which we have seen. I know he struggled with Holloway, but still, if you just think about the highlights of that fight, not the the performance, Cater did land some pretty good shots in some of that fight.
If you think you can box with power and volume for five rounds like Calvin Cater, you're fucked.
No. But there's nothing in his boxing that's like, wow, he's not throwing 360 switch kicks. There's not a lot of spinning techniques. There's not a lot of Habib-type grappling. It's a lot of jabs. No, it's a lot of combination.
It's a lot like that Space Cadet song by Metro Boomin. Aim a lot of sticks like it's laser tag. That's exactly what Calvin Cater does in every single one of his fights.
I don't think I can strike like Calvin Cater, Craig. I don't think anybody who listened to what I just said thinks that I came across thinking I could strike like Calvin Cater.
Okay, well, for Calvin Cater, again, the big point that I had, if you look at it in his fight against Josh Emmett his last time out, it was a really tight one. I thought Cater won, and on the rewatch as well, he won round one, round four, and round five. Emmett had a good shot round two, round three. Round five was the one that was fairly close. Emmett was throwing the big power shots. Cater showed
a good chin.
Land with volume, and Cater had him busted up by the end of that one. So, I mean, you look at that one, 130 significant strikes for him in that fight. One leg kick. He went one of one with leg kicks. His other win that he had against Chikadze, 144 significant strikes, four leg kicks. Like, Cater's not a big kicker at all, which is something in a fight against Arnold Allen that if you check a lot of Allen kicks, you're going to have a good night out. If you land with a lot of volume in your boxing, you back up Arnold Allen, you're going to have a really good night. And I look at the fight that Allen had against Sadiq Yusuf where he got backed up a lot. He got kind of caught waiting a little bit. He landed that big power shot, got the knockdown in the first round. Yusuf kind of rallied back round two, round three. And I know Allen won that one by unanimous decision. Everybody had Allen winning, but he had a little bit of a case for Yusuf in that matchup. And Allen, his last time out against Hooker. Now, is Hooker a journeyman? What is he at this point? Earth. I don't know. But yeah, Arnold Allen, uptick in aggression. Team Renegade. I'll throw the picture up there of his dad with Leon Edwards. You imagine fight like if Arnold Allen and his dad came walking up to you in a back alley, you run the other way,
right?
It's
weird because they both seem like two of the nicer men you'd ever come across. Yeah, but yes, it's off of physique alone, you would run the other way.
It's like Lance the Party Palmer and his dad.
Yeah.
Like, I would not want to see those guys in an alley because their dads would beat the fuck out of you.
This is my question. Can Arnold Allen hurt Calvin Cater? I think that's an important question you have to ask yourself because Calvin Cater is like Michael Bisping, for instance. He's someone who can throw with power, but he doesn't throw for the potential of power. Like, there's two different types of strikers. And I always think, because middleweight's an easy way to describe it. Michael Bisping is all volume, not a lot of power. Yes, he has some knockout wins, but for the most part, it was historical volume that would get guys out of there. The other side of that would be Wanderlei Silva. Wanderlei would load up on every shot like crazy. He would telegraph his punches. But the thing is, if you don't get out of the way of those punches, there's some devastating consequences that are going to come along with those. Calvin Cater is much more similar to Bisping than he is Wanderlei, where he just let the technique flows naturally. He does have power again. Don't misconstrue my words and think that Calvin Cater doesn't have power, but he doesn't throw trying to knock guys out, and I think that's important because Allen can have both those versions. He can be the steady fighter, and that's the other thing too. I don't think five rounds is going to affect Arnold Allen. I think Arnold Allen's a good steady fighter. I know he might not always fight at the exact same pace for every single round, but I think he's a steady enough fighter and a cerebral enough fighter to understand what situation he's in. Now, yes, I favor the fact, and you brought it up a few times now, so I feel like it's going to be a big point of yours. Calvin Cater has been in a number of UFC main events up until this point.
And he fights about the same in every round.
Exactly. Like I said, both these guys I would say are cut from the same cloth. Now, the difference is, I know Calvin Cater could be steady for five rounds, but I do think Arnold Allen's the type of guy who, again, he doesn't throw with everything with power. He can throw with volume. He's not the most aggressive guy we've ever seen, even though, yes, last time we saw him go out there and throw with a lot of power. I just think this has all the makings of a classic. I think we're going to get a great fight this
and
Saturday.
The last time that Arnold Allen lost, it was years ago against Marcin Rocek that's been with KSW. He's on the Ultimate Fighter season 22 with the GOAT Artem Lobov. And for Allen, if you do look at it, he's a lot lower in terms of his volume compared to Calvin Cater. And he debuted back in 2015. So he's been around in the UFC longer than Calvin Cater has. And I do look at it. I mean, he's got a really nice left cross in close. That's what drops Sadiq Yusuf. He mixes in his wrestling when he needs to. And he can drop his levels
with that head kick
quite
too
easily. He's got really good kicks in his repertoire. But if you want to crowd the kicker, we saw Cater do that to chop liver Giga Chikadze with everybody on this channel. And they're not fans of him anymore. But the same can be said because a lot of people don't like Calvin Cater and the fact that he's been in some of these wars. He's been in with a lot of power punchers, a lot of volume numbers. And that Max Holloway fight, I know it was, 445 significant strikes that Holloway landed, an all-time historic
just
number.
Just that no-look right hand.
And that weighs down Cater's, like, you know, significant strike numbers historically. But if you just take away that one fight for Cater, it's the volume, it's the presence in every round, and it's the fact that he doesn't get dropped or knocked down in his fights, and he drops and knocks down a lot of his opponents. So you do look at this one. I mean, Arnold Allen, I just touched on it a little bit before I talked about, you know, the fact that his dad's yoked. Arnold Allen trains at Team Renegade. You might know that gym for Leon Edwards, Fabian Edwards. You might know it for, you know, Tom Breeze. It's over with Levels Fighting. Or their other teammate that just got a win this month with Levels, and Aiden Lee that fought with Bellator and Cage Warriors. He got a submission win at the start of the month.
He's always in the gym, too. That must be said. Like, Arnold Allen is always just posting stuff of him training on Instagram, and that's it.
I would hope. Like, not
But no, it's just like, there's some fighters who are like, oh, I'm on vacation now. I'm doing all these different press, like, performances and stuff with all these different...
Calling out guys, taking pictures of their abs and their underwear.
Yeah, like, Arnold Allen very much is, like, kind of a salt-of-the-earth fighter, if you will. And that's why I think this is a great opportunity for him. We brought up the fact that Calvin Kattar, again, I think he is sort of in that Derek Brunson category right now, where he's kind of a forever top five. He's going to be a difficult fight for anybody in the rankings. Going to beat a lot of those ranked fighters too, but I do think against the elite of the elite, we talked with the Ortegas of the world, the Volkanovskis, the Holloways, the Yair Rodriguez. I think he might come up short against those. I guess Josh Emmett also has to be mentioned in that category as well. But outside of those, Calvin Kattar is going to have a great chance against anybody, because again, his defense is good enough to keep the fight where he excels. Again, I just keep on coming back to the questions of, does Arnold Allen have enough power to hurt Calvin Kattar? Because we have seen Kattar get stunned on the feet. You're right. We've never seen him get knocked out or knocked down. He does have a very durable chin. But we have seen him get hit by a strike, kind of turtle up and back up in fights. It's happened in numerous amounts of fights. So I'll be very curious to see if Arnold Allen can have that kind of power. Because I think Arnold Allen hits really hard. Of course, he doesn't hit as hard as Josh Emmett. I think Josh Emmett kind of stands alone in this division for his punching power. But I do think Arnold Allen can hurt Calvin Kattar. And I think that's what's going to come down in this fight. I think Kattar will be the steadier guy with his jab, with his output. But I think it's going to come down to, A, I think it's going to go to a decision. B, I think both guys are going to look good in the fifth round. So I think both those things are very important. And C, I think Cater's the steadier guy, but I do think Arnold Allen has the potential to hurt Calvin Kattar. And that's why I'm so in the middle about this fight. I think this fight, you hate it when people say, oh, it could be a split decision, could be a draw. But this is one of those fights where we could have kind of two rounds where, oh, Kattar won those two rounds, Arnold won those two rounds. You have a fifth round that might be razor close and everybody's mad about the decision.
Like Calvin Kattar's last fight.
Exactly. So Kattar isn't new to these kind of these decisions, but I really do love the matchmaking in this fight. I can't say this enough. I really love how these guys match up.
Not a lot of you voted in the community tab for this one. What are you doing? Head over to the community tab. We threw it out to you a few hours ago. 59% with Arnold Allen, 41% with Kattar. We threw it on out to the Instagram community, and it's about the same. 63% Arnold Allen with the votes in the comments section. Travis says, since it's five rounds, I have to go with Kattar. Bo saying the broken nose versus the broken hand.
True.
Benny, big Kattar fan, but he's taken too much damage in the past. And Russ saying second round TKO Allen. The odds are about even in this matchup. So Matt, odds are even. Fans pretty well overwhelmingly have Arnold Allen. I think you've set it up one way, but who do you have in the pick here?
Here's the thing. You say I've set it up one way, but I must say this. All week long and leading up to this event, I really thought Calvin Kattar would be the favorited fighter, and I really thought I would find myself picking Calvin Kattar in this matchup.
I think he boxes Arnold Allen's ears in.
Here's the thing. He might, but Arnold Allen's a way better wrestler. He has submission abilities. I think he does have a good enough chin to at least make this competitive. That's what I mean. I keep on stalling because I have no idea who's going to win this fight. I really do think there's a world out there where Arnold Allen uses his leg kicks really effectively, because that's something you had brought up too. Calvin Kattar's a great striker, but when we talk about his striking, it is primarily the boxing, a lot less with the kicks. So I think there is a world where Arnold Allen at range can really effectively use the calf kick, mix in the body and the head kick, be one of those three-level strikers that we like to talk about. But I guess it's sort of like a Swiss Army knife and a machete. A Swiss Army knife's going to do more stuff. But if you need something cut, you're probably going to go with the machete. And if this fight's on the feet, again, I think it's a close one. Because
make a f***ing pick.
Craig, I think Arnold Allen's a more well-rounded fighter. But I guess I do think this fight's primarily going to take place on the feet. And that's why I have Calvin Kattar. I like the jab of Kattar. I think he's going to go to the body a lot in this fight. And I think that's going to be an interesting thing for both guys. Arnold Allen is the more likely to go to the body and go to the legs. But Calvin Kattar, with that five-round experience, I could see him trying to test the gas tank of Arnold Allen. Really test that early. Because, again, Kattar is the more proven guy as it goes late. But I can't say this enough. I think this fight's going to be incredible.
No, and I know how hard it was for you to make the pick. pick, and that's why I'm giving you a hard time. I'm just kidding around. But when I do look at this one, Matt, my reasoning for it is Cater long ago fought a guy just like Arnold Allen at 145 pounds at home. Cater was the underdog, plus 180. And he's at UFC 220, and he fights Shane Burgos, and he finishes Shane Burgos.
Burgos doesn't kick, though. Allen does.
Burgos throws a lot of heavy boxing combinations, not a ton of volume. And we've seen Burgos turn into a wrestler as his UFC career went on. We'll see if that plays out with PFL when he takes on Marlon Moraes. Why did they make that fight?
I don't want to watch it. Like, I like Marlon Moraes. I like Shane Burgos. I don't want to see a bantamweight fight a massive featherweight.
Ray Safo, you can stop it. You can just
rip up the
contract. We don't need to see it. But for me, that's why I have Calvin Kattar. I like the volume. I like the pressure. The other thing with Arnold Allen that we didn't mention, I think this is a big point that you were starting to allude to. His movement front to back and side to side, he doesn't allow fighters to cut the cage, which is something that Calvin Kattar does incredibly well. So is the final pick Calvin Kattar in this one?
It is, but again, you're going to have to check in with Question Mark Kicks, which luckily starts 2 hours before the first prelim does, for us to go through our last pick on the card, because I gave Craig a hard time leading up to this. He has switched one fight on both of the last two cards, which unfortunately for him has not turned in his direction, but again, I can't say this enough. I think this is a very fun main event. It's an important main event too, because I do think the winner then joins the club of the elite in the featherweight division, where the loser just kind of remains good, if not very great, but sort of avoids the elite of the elite. So this is one of the better fight night main events we've had in a while. I think that's fair to say. And this is one of those fights that could easily be like a pay-per-view main card fight. I'm just happy it's a 5-round affair.
And there are 9 fights on this card right now. Christian Rodriguez, Garrett Armfield off the card on short notice Sunday. The notes were written, the graphics were done, and we don't get to talk about it. And of course, you also have Grant Dawson, Mark Madsen that was moved to next weekend's card. So we would assume that they're going to add a few more fights to this card. And we will have those out as individual videos along with these 9 in their individual formats as quickly as we can possibly get them out there for you folks. So make sure you toss a like on the video. So many of you did last weekend and the subscriptions went wild. It was like Hulkamania in the late 80s, early 90s. So thanks so much for all the support out there. 2 hours before the prelims is Question Mark Kicks. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.